Jason. Thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. Very sorry I'll miss the soccer game and the cheerleading. It sounds like it would have been fun. So I was asked today to give an overview, sort of lecture, about status of SUSY breaking models, and presumably from the point of view of a particle physics phenomenologist, because that's what I am. So this is actually a pretty difficult task. When I was going over and trying to figure out how to organize all the progress and make sure I got everything, I realized this is pretty hopeless to figure out some sort of taxonomy that actually is clear and logical and puts everybody in the right box. So you'll see my attempt, and I tried very hard to be inclusive and not miss anything important if I did, and hopefully I didn't miss anything from anybody in this room. But if I did, please feel free to pipe in and tell me whatever should be there that is not. Okay. So this is the outline of my presentation. I'm going to start with a brief introduction and motivation for supersymmetry, even though we really don't probably need that here. I'll talk about the MSSM parameter space and just show you some notation. Again, most of us already know all this, but this is just in case things show up later. And they do from time to time. You'll see my notation and my conventions and things like that. So then I'll start trying to come up with some kind of catalog of the various SUSY models and qualitatively discuss a little bit about their LHC implications. So there are world experts in this room about LHC phenomenology. I don't include myself in that category, but I do know something about basically the main feature that I'm interested in is understanding the differences in the superpartner spectrum of TeV energies, basically, right? So usually you have some model, you start at running some parameters at some particular scale. It could be high, it could be low, depending on what mechanism you're dealing with. And just looking basically at certain fundamental features. In fact, a lot of us in phenomenology have been doing our own sort of landscape studies, as you'll see, where we basically scan through model parameters and look at the lightest spore superparticles, for example. That's just an example of the kind of signatures you're going to see, because those lightest ones are going to be the things, of course, that are going to dictate how the cascade decays go and things like that. So qualitatively, that's what I'll look at. And I'm going to start after I said lots of thinking about the right way to do this. I decided to start with familiarity, okay, because I figured that's always a good place to start. I'm going to start by reviewing some very standard mechanisms and very minimal scenarios that have been around for a very long time, some of them even enjoying close to their 30th birthday. Okay, and the paradigm is, of course, minimal supergravity, also known as the CMSSM. And I'm going to review that in some detail, including sort of the latest up-to-date things. And my main reason for doing so is not because you haven't seen these things before, but rather because basically oftentimes we use this model as the prototype for everything for SUSY phenomenology. And you see this and you think, this is how the thing works. And basically what I want to show to you, and people are starting to look at this in more detail than they have been, that all you have to do is add one new parameter, perturb away by one parameter, almost arbitrarily, and you can take any possible conclusion you can come up with from MSUGRA or CMSSM and falsify it. So for example, where the dark matter allowed regions are and things like that. So I want to go over that in some detail just to show you that all this is a very important set of models, and pretty much all the phenomenology practically is based on it, almost all the benchmark points studied. One can't extrapolate too quickly without thinking about what one's doing. Then going beyond the minimal scenarios, I'd like to try to go through examples of what I'm going to call theory motivated. Okay, so both from the top down and the bottom up. Okay, and I'm going to go through some example. The one I have the most detail on is the subject that I've been working on, which is a scenario I call deflected mirage mediation, which is a generalization of the sort of well-known mirage scenario to include contributions from gauge mediation, which I think is actually a pretty nice phenomenological framework. And so with that, I should be done, and we'll see how long this takes. All right, so let's talk about supersymmetry, which we've been looking for since the 70s and 80s, right? And, you know, I can't resist putting on Madonna, especially from the 80s. You know, yeah, she was around probably wondering where supersymmetry was as well. I don't think she cares now, but okay, she's moved on. But we haven't, so we all know there are many benefits and features to, well, she's got other issues, don't worry. So basically, we have many benefits and features to low-energy supersymmetry. We all know these. Of course, the number one is the hierarchy problem. We also have gauge coupling unification emerging in some natural way from the low-energy point of view. The Higgs sector, we have some understanding of it. We have some understanding of radiative electroweak symmetry breaking. With the assumption of a conserved R parity, we get a dark matter candidate, the LSP, for free, meaning we put the R parity in to solve other problems to make sure we all exist so that the proton doesn't decay instantaneously. But when we do this, we get out something that actually can be useful and typically gives you the right sort of size for the relic abundance of dark matter under some assumptions. It may provide source for the baryonic symmetry. This is an unknown. Okay, it has the ingredients to do so. Whether the phenomenological constraints on the allowed region of parameters actually provides this is not clear yet. We also have the fact that it's a theory which enjoys decoupling, meaning that unlike many other ideas for new physics at the TeV scale, as you sort of increase superparticle masses, what they happen is they sort of smoothly decouple from low energy processes. So it's not like other scenarios you have strong coupling and you basically can't get rid of these things. So if you haven't seen them, you're pretty much dead. So it's survived for a long time, almost as long as Madonna, and she's here again. So it's good for some phenomenology, but it's not good for everything. And I wanted to just point out some of the issues right away because we're going to come back to them. So first of all, we're going to have CP and flavor problems, which I'm going to talk about pretty much right away. Okay. Unlike the standard model, or different ones in the standard model. Okay. There's also issues like, for example, baryon and lepton number conservation is sort of not exact. We have also the fact that the non-observation of superpartners under this assumption of sort of low-energy supersymmetry, the fact that we haven't seen them yet after a decade or so of looking at various experiments means that there's some tension between the electroweak scale and that of the SUSY scale. Okay, this is called the little hierarchy problem. Okay, there's also various cosmological problems I'm not going to go into much detail about. Okay. Still, I would say arguably, even though it's in its 30s, okay, you know, it's arguably the most robust known framework for physics beyond the standard model. It's survived. It's still the most interesting thing, and many of us are placing our bets on it. And we're very excited that the LHC era is finally happening so that we can finally have some definitive tests of this scenario. Now, there are many types of SUSY models one can write down. One can just take this sort of simplest extension of the standard model, add supersymmetry to it. That's the minimal supersymmetric standard model, the MSSM. It's defined by having two Higgs doublets and a conserved R parity, and that's all. That's my definition of the MSSM, and that's what I'm going to focus on. So many of us here in this room also work on extended models from that, so where you add extra gauge groups, extra particles, gut symmetries, etc. I'm not going to do that for the most part here. This is just for simplicity. In fact, in many cases, in fact, those of us working on string phenomenology know very often in string models, you do get those extra things, so you might argue that it's important to look at them. And that's true, but let's start with something simple. We'll see, we're already going to have a lot of complication to cope with. Okay, so let's just review the MSSM and its parameter space. So here are all the particles. We all know this. There are two Higgs doublets, H up and H down. Tangent beta is the famous parameter relating to the ratio of the vacuum expectation values of the two Higgses. Okay. We have the supersymmetric interactions by the superpotential. Okay. Here we have Yukawa coupling of the up-type quarks, down-type quarks, leptons, and the Higgsino mass term mu, okay, supersymmetric Higgsino mass term. And I'm not putting in the neutrinos, okay, again, just for simplicity. Okay. Obviously, we know we do have to worry about neutrino masses, but I'm not going to worry about it here today. Okay. And some of our notation is from our review. And another great review that everyone knows is one by Martin from 97. So let's talk about the SUSY breaking sector. This is the sector we're interested in. And there are set categories of different parameters. We have the Gaugino masses, 1, 2, and 3, for U1 hypercharge, SU2 left, and SU3 color. Here they are here. Okay. Then we have a bilinear scalar coupling, little b. We often call this capital B times mu, where mu is that Higgsino mass parameter in the superpotential. So that's here. Okay. Then we have trilinear scalar couplings. I'm calling them A tildes here. And you see, these are matrices in flavor space. These I and J label flavor indices. So they're 3x3 matrices. Okay. I'm calling them A tilde because they're just the coupling in the Lagrangian. We very often in phenomenology factor out Yukawa coupling. It turns out and basically when you generate these things in any kind of model, they turn out to be proportional to the corresponding Yukawa coupling in the superpotential. But their proportionality is not necessarily some matrix multiplication or something simple. Okay. So therefore, when you have something where you really do think about all three families, it's easy sometimes just to stick with this one. Okay. Now we also have the soft scalar mass squareds. Again, 3x3 matrices. And here we have one for the quark doublets, the lepton doublets, the up-type quark singlets, the down-type quark singlets, and the lepton singlets. Okay, so here are all our parameters, and when you count them, you find you have 105. So this is just if you write down the most general soft breaking term in the simplest supersymmetric extension, you get 105 new parameters. And then immediately, if you're a phenomenologist, you're in the soup, because no experimentalist is ever going to even think about they don't want to deal with more than five, okay? So how do you cope with this impractically vast number of parameters? And so what you do is you say, well, first of all, there's no full mapping of this enormously complicated parameter space. But we do know that in most of the viable regions, many of these parameters have to be extraordinarily small, and we can safely ignore them for a lot of our purposes. So the first set of assumptions I'm going to make is about the Suzy flavor and CP problem. So essentially, the very fact that these various couplings here, so these trilinear couplings and also the mass squares, they have off-diagonal terms. You might say, well, in what basis? So we're in the basis where the fermions have been diagonalized. So if supersymmetry was exact, if you diagonalize the fermions, their partners would be diagonalized too. But we know Suzy is broken. That Suzy breaking could have a flavor dependence to it. If it does, then in the basis where the fermions are diagonal, okay, the scalars have off-diagonal entries. Those off-diagonal entries are killers, especially for the first and second family, and especially in the down quark sector, because they overproduce KK bar mixing like crazy. Okay, so what you do is you parameterize some of these things. Let me walk over here for a second. And we write, when we do this, we write these delta parameters. So you just sort of, this is in this basis where the fermions are diagonal. It's called the super secam basis. Here's the mass squared matrix of some fermion, some spermion, okay? So a squark or a slepton. Here's some off-diagonal entry, and then here's sort of divided by some common scale, okay? And there's a more precise way to find the scale, and people who do this for a living are much more precise than this. This is sort of at the squiggle level, okay? But essentially, when you look at the real parts, in many sectors, there sort of have to be at least 10 to minus 2. Imaginary parts, even more so, this 10 to minus 5 is for a certain, what's called the left-right mixing parameter for the down quark sector, and that's because of epsilon prime over epsilon in the kaon sector. Just, that's it. So if you want to try to mess around with flavor structure in these fermions, you're extraordinarily constrained. So for a lot of what we want to do for collider phenomenology, we don't want to do that. So thinking about, for example, B system or other things, you might want to worry about this. But for our purposes, we're not going to want to. So one of the things we're going to do is we're going to essentially set all these off-diagonal terms to zero. Okay. And let me also point out, the strongest ones are really constraints, of course, are first and second family. The third is much weaker, so you have some room to wiggle around. But again, some of them are much more strongly constrained than others, and it's a complicated mess. This is actually the bulk of the parameters, by the way, if you really count them. A lot of the parameters are these CKM-like angles in these fermion matrices and CP violating phases in those particular quantities. Now there's also what's called a flavor-independent Suzy CP problem. So I also already talked about a CP problem in the off-diagonal entries, but you can also have CP phases in some of these other parameters. So let me talk about that. I'm going to go back one more slide again. For example, these gay genos, they can have phases in them. Okay? The mu term can have a phase. The B mu can have a phase. These A's can have phases that are flavor diagonal. There'd be some overall phase here. Here these guys don't have flavor. Now, why do we care so much about flavor diagonal couplings? It's because, well, in the standard model, we don't have them, and that's very fortunate, because if they're around, they tend to give you a huge contribution to electric dipole moments. Okay. If the new physics is a TEV scale, those phases typically have to be constrained down to order 10 to minus 2 or so. And I tried to write this in a sort of a little bit kind of boring and pedantic way, but I used to work on this, as Gordy can attest to. And so when you work on these phases, you start going crazy, because people just, you can't talk about a phase without talking about some basis independent combination. Because otherwise, some people work in some basis, some people work in others, and everyone's talking about the phase of mu, which you can rotate away by some transformation. So you say, okay, enough. So we have these two basic quantities here. We have to call them phi 1 f, phi 2 lambda. The thing to notice is that this one essentially involves the phases of the trilinears. This one involves the phases of the gay genos, and these are sort of a basis to describe all these things. Essentially, if you have any one of these individually turned on, you're dead from respect to the EDMs. Okay? Now, you could imagine you have a number of them turned on at once, and perhaps there's some giant conspiracy, and I worked on things like this, believe it or not, where there's some giant conspiracy where all the big terms cancel and you get nothing. Actually, some of those cancellations do happen. I mean, that often happens when you're working on these kinds of things. You work out and you see some big quantity, and then you realize you forgot the term that's also big with a minus sign that cancels it exactly. So that does happen sometimes, but not in general. There's no symmetry that's restored somehow if all these contributions cancel. So it's an accident if it happens, or if these things are governed by a theory, at least some statement about the theory, or whatever that might be. So the point is, you can have cancellations. You could let these phases turn on. I'm just, for the purposes of this talk, basically going to say, let's just forget about them too. So let's just invoke what I call minimal flavor violation. I'm not the one who calls it this, everybody calls it this, where we say all the flavor structure in these soft terms comes from the Yukawa couplings and superpotential, not from the supersymmetry breaking part. So that's tantamount to saying that when we rotate the thing, we're going to end up getting things that are essentially diagonal on the superkinion basis. Okay? So then we don't have to worry about all these crazy flavor changing rear decays that don't happen in the standard model. Okay? I'm also going to do what I said just before. I'm going to set these flavor diagonal CP phases to zero. Okay? This is for simplicity. And again, to avoid worrying about the EDMs. I have a little note about that. Because these flavor diagonal ones, I argued before that the flavor off diagonal is not so important for purposes of the collider physics. Flavor diagonal will show up in many collider physics processes, even CP conserving ones, as cosine of some angle, some of those phase angles I just showed you. So they can affect how you extract parameters. But as I said, that's a caveat that for now, since it's so correlated with these EDM constraints, which are severe, we're just going to switch them off. Okay. So if we do that, our 105 turns out to about 20 that are relevant. Okay, there's still too many. Experimentals still get mad at you. Okay. They still say, forget it, I don't know what you're talking about, you know. It's crazy, come up with something more interesting, you know. So, but this is just to sort of lay out what these things are. So we have three gay genome masses, okay. Now the trilinear couplings, now these are these little A's, these capital A's without the tilde, so I've included the Yukawa coupling dependence. That's why the third family is the only one that matters, essentially, okay. Because they get multiplied by larger Yukawas. First and second families, those Yukawas are so small, that even if these things are reasonably sized, they don't do much anyway. So let's just forget about them. So we have these three, okay? We have these usual Higgs parameters, mu and b mu. For the scalar mass squared parameters, these m squareds, will make the first and second generations, basically, they can be different for each of these different particles, but between the two families, they're the same. Okay, so m squared, q1, and q2 are the same. This just avoids our kaon physics problems easily. Third generation can be different, as I said, because the constraints on third generation mixing are much weaker. Okay? So that's about our 20 parameters. Because here, each of these is basically 10, right? So what you can do is the following. Given those 20, there's sort of two options. One option, which people have actually done, is say, let's just take that 20, and let's just go crazy and start studying it. Okay? Or we can look at that 20 and we can say, okay, well, I know certain regions, so suppose I want to look at a region where electroweak baryogenesis is going to happen. Then I know that the M2 has to be this and something else has to be that, and I could sort of perturb in a certain region. Okay. So you can look either at the full set explicitly or in just certain regions that you're wanting to look for. So, and there are many such regions people have identified. So if you want to make sure you get sort of large enough stop loops, you have less of a problem with getting a Higgs mass big enough, you have a certain region you go into. If you want to get baryogenesis, you have another region. So there's various things people have done like that. Another thing you can do is this supersymmetry without prejudice, where these guys basically took that 20 parameter space and they just scanned over it and they did their sort of landscape study by imposing a whole bunch of bounds, because there's a whole bunch of bounds that are coming up. Okay. In fact, I think in the next slide I'll talk about them. Now Gordy, actually back when I was working with him a very long time ago, Gordy, another postdoc friend of mine, also worked at the time, much earlier than people were thinking about this, on what he called minimal reasonable models, which some subset of this 20, but he also put in some of these phases. So just to point out, people have done this kind of thing before. It's just sort of get out of the box of sort of just making too many simplifying assumptions. So that's one sort of thing one can do. And this is pretty much all I'm going to say about this here. The second, which is going to be the goal of the talk today, is to talk about attempts to build models of Susie breaking to reduce this 20 or so parameters to a manageable set. Okay. And so I'm going to come up with this taxonomy of the models. As I keep telling you, it's probably going to be incomplete, although I did my best to do a reasonable job of saying a lot of the things at least I know about. And what I'll do is we'll eventually start with this hidden sector paradigm, which we all know is sort of how you build SUSY models, come to this prototype example, and then go further to explore more.
But when you do supersymmetry without prejudice,
yes.
Are you forced any regions of parameter space?
Well, what they did is they kind of... What they think made their main point in that paper, which was they did like sort of, they looked at these lightest particles and they imposed a ton of bounds. And you'd want to see if you get sort of different types of patterns than what you get, for example, in M-Sugar, and they do. I mean, it's what you expect. I mean, it's sort of, you have many more options. And so they also didn't know how to put priors on the scans. So that's another problem with these kinds of things. So we all have these problems when you do that kind of study. So they did it with flat and with log, and they're trying to make assumptions. But I think it's just to sort of to show that you can actually take those 20 parameters and do something with it. It was, I think, a heroic effort, if I remember. I remember this person, Carola Berger, gave a very nice talk, and Madison, God, I think it was like at least more than a year and a half before the paper came out. And she was like, it's almost out, you know. And then, so anyway, it was a lot of work for these people. Quite impressive. So I wanted to talk about some of the bounds, because no matter what you do, you're going to have to make sure your model satisfies certain basic features, at least your parameter states of your model. And these are the things, for example, that the SUSY without prejudice people also impose, these same types of bounds. So let's start with the very easy ones. We know that since we've assumed our parity is conserved here, that whatever your lightest superpartner is, it better be stable. Oh, sorry, and neutral. It better be neutral, otherwise if it's charged and stable, you're dead from the cosmological point of view. So it's this stable, neutral thing that sort of led us to understand that for a very long time, this is very well known, that if this missing transverse energy collider signatures because these stable thing basically you don't see in the detector, and et cetera. So this is going to put some constraints on any model. Okay. Many models, you might think it looks great, but then you end up getting an LSP that's totally the wrong thing, and you're dead right away. There's also electroweak symmetry breaking. One of the triumphs of supersymmetry is that, in general, you can use this radiative electroweak symmetry breaking mechanism and get the right sort of Z mass and things like that coming out. But what you have to do is make sure your parameters basically make that happen with the correct values. You have to make sure your minimum is stable, no tachyonic directions for anything, no charging. If you're really serious, you should make sure there's no deeper charge and color breaking minima or unbounded from below directions. Okay, so you have to look at that. There's also what's called the mu problem and also the mu slash b mu problem.
Sorry, why do you care if there are CCBs as long as the tunneling rate from your vacuum is long?
You can not care about that if you do that calculation, yes. But the thing is, these scalar potentials in these SUSY models, have so many of them, it's just, yeah, it's so complicated that I think it's almost intractable to do such a thing. But people do sometimes look at such scenarios. So yes, absolutely. So, and even when you say this, it's really just, you can look at certain, you know, simplified directions and say, aha, we know. So the folklore is if some of the A terms for involving the quarks are too big, typically that trilinear is going to take over and dominate and you're going to have some problem. And so you kind of know sort of roughly. The detailed analysis is not something people do. Okay. Now, with the new problem, this is to basically to understand why the parameter superpotential, which is the Higgsino mass, has to be the same size as the soft terms. It's sort of different origin. This is a well-known, you know, it's a quote problem that's been known for so long, and there's many possible solutions to it. So some people, when they say mu problem, they say, well, what mu problem? There's many solutions, just pick one. So yes. However, that usually involves some other model building in your theory. And if you predict mu and b, then what you have is you predict the value of the z mass you get. And you better make sure that's right. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Now, often people avoid it because it is some sort of additional model building constraint. And you just trade instead the Z mass and tangent beta, which is that ratio of the Higgs-Debs, for the mu and B, and you're left only with the sine of mu. So you see sine of mu floating around. That just means you've done that. Okay. Now, one thing I mentioned about mu slash B mu problem is that turns out in SUSY breaking models, you typically need for things to come out into the right order, there can't be too much of a hierarchy between mu and B. Okay? So remember, this B is basically the it's also a dimension of mass, so it's the thing that's going in the scalar potential only, where the mu is the thing that's in the superpotential. So it turns out that in a lot of models it comes out just naturally, they're similar order, you don't have to do that much, but in some mediation mechanism for SUSY breaking, which I'll talk about, if you get one right, the other one's screwed up. And it's actually quite serious. And so in many cases this is a huge challenge and people go off, but for a lot of times when you're sort of looking at some particular model, you tend to sort of defer that for future and sort of sweep it under the rug, but it's important to mention it since we're here. Another thing is to think about fine-tuning. This is, again, something that some people focus on more than others. The idea is, as I said, typically you have to have superpartner masses to satisfy certain bounds. Often you want to relate the SUSY breaking scale to the electroweak scale, and therefore there is a little bit of tuning, and it depends on the type of scenario you have. Okay, and so people do studies like this, and this is what's called a little hierarchy problem. So you can worry about those things as well. So all those are sort of just the theoretical kind of constraints. Let's think more about actual constraints from experiments. Okay, and I didn't write them all down, but I wrote down a few. So there's direct collider bounds on certain superpartner masses. Okay, I mean, they searched for these things and didn't find them. So let me forget about the Higgs for the moment. Here's, for example, the stop and the stow. There's certain bounds on them. Okay, and here's the Chargino. But let me, I wanted to write all these down just to comment that many of these bounds have assumptions built into them. So you can't just randomly take them out of some, look at some PDG or people talking about Susie and say, I have some model, let me put this bound in. The reason is, for example, the Chargino bound is gone if the Chargino and Neutralino are very degenerate. By very degenerate, I mean in the order of PGV, which actually happens in a lot of models. So if you apply that bound, it's insane, because there's no way they can actually see, they can never see this, because when you have such a degeneracy, your decay products are just too soft to be seen in the detector, right? So you have to kind of track down these things. And actually, a lot of these bounds, they work great for minimal supergravity / CMSSM. That's why they float around so much, because most of the phenomena are on that. You don't have those problems there. Things are very stretched out, as I'll show you in a moment. But in many other models, that's not the case, so you have to be careful. And they also comment about the lightest Higgs. You might say, well, what about 114 GV? Well, yes, okay. So this is a very soft constraint, but remember the Higgs sector in the MSSM is more complicated. You can have regions of parameter space where the lightest Higgs is not fully standard model-like, and therefore the standard model-like bounds don't hold. Most of us are actually a little uncomfortable with this. It seems a little too generous. Probably want it to be a little higher than that. But you'd have to look at a specific model. If you're doing a scan, you might have parameter points where that's fine. Okay, just so you know. So this is just some subset of them. There's also things like bounds on gluinos and stuff, but the main point here is every one of these things you've got to go and look at and make sure that if you're applying them to a certain scenario, that you're not applying the wrong thing. Okay, because you might cut out perfectly viable points of your parameter space because you're sort of thinking M Sugra, which we all do because we all grew up on that. After all, it's, you know, 30 years old. It's as old as Susie practically, right? So, okay. Now we also have indirect constraints. And again, I didn't list all of them. I listed just a few. Okay, so I listed, these are the ones that were used, for example, in that Susie without prejudice study. So they worried about the rho parameter, okay, which is some electroweak constraint. You know, it's the ratio basically of Z and W masses, which has to be very small. I mean, it's basically the delta rho means the change in rho from one. Okay, that thing, we know it's got to be very tiny. There's also, let me start over here, there's also the G minus two of the muon, the contribution from new physics. Now, we know this thing has been around for a long time. The standard model prediction is actually incredibly difficult because it, many sectors have involved very difficult hadronic physics that one cannot do from first principles. There's always some 2.6 sigma bound floating around that sort of changes a little bit when people redo a standard model part, and then the experiment comes up and it bumps up again, and it always sort of fixates around that number. It's not a very strong number. Nevertheless, it would put a constraint on your models because TEV scale supersymmetry will, in general, contribute to this thing.
Is the sign there minus 5.7? Is that what you meant?
I think I did, but I can't guarantee it off the top of my head. Okay.
I thought delta mu had been bigger than zero this
way. Yeah. I'll check. Yeah. It's okay?
Yeah.
Depends how many standard deviations you
have. Yeah, well, it depends on what that means, delta mu.
Yeah.
It's just deviation from the standard.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think usually these things are like in two sigma range is sort of what people usually do. Now, there's also B2S gamma, which I put a little arrow by because this is really the model killer, you know. And in fact, one of my collaborators called it that once, and now it's just stuck in my head. So now every time I see it, that's what I think. But it's actually really true. So B2S gamma is a rare decay in a standard model. It shows up at a loop. So anything, Susie shows up at a loop too. So the loop, basically in a standard model, right, would involve a top quark and a W. So supersymmetry is that you have a stop and a Chargino. Okay. There's also many other contributions because you could have neutralino or some neutral eno thing, glueno, whatever, and a squark of the other, you know, down type, for example. The problem with B2S gamma, or maybe the good thing about it, is, well, there are two problems with it. The first one is that it seems to be right where the standard model tells you. Okay? So in supersymmetry, if we just take the simplest kind of thing without any possible flavor structure in it, then you're going to have that stop Chargino diagram, and you also have a charged Higgs where the W is supposed to be. And those guys have to cancel each other. And in simple models, that's what tells you that there's only one sign of mu allowed, for example. Okay, so it's pretty strong. Now, if you go to models where there are flavor violation allowed, there's actually many more contributions, and there's a lot more things you can do. But that's actually very complicated. This thing has also been calculated some crazy order in QCD, too. I mean, so if you really want to if you really want to put your number up against data, you have to do a lot of work, you know. So it's a serious constraint on our models. Okay. Another kind of interesting decay, which just has not been observed yet, this is a bound, but look, it's a pretty severe bound, is the B sub S goes to mu mu. This thing turns out to be in supersymmetry. I don't remember the standard model prediction off my head, but it's very small.
Times 10 to the minus 9.
Okay, good. So in supersymmetry, it turns out that this thing goes like tan beta to the 6th power. So if you have a large tan beta model, this is a serious constraint on it. Okay. Similarly, this delta A mu is something that some scales with tan beta in a particular way. So the larger tan beta typically has more problems with this. Actually, all of these things do. Okay. So in general, these things are very severe and important. There's other sorts of rare decays one can impose that are less important. But nevertheless, many people do that. I'm just sort of giving you the highlights here. So these are the things we have to make sure that our models obey. And we're not done. This is an assumption. The assumption is that the neutralino is the LSP, and it's dark matter. We're going to assume further that it's standard cosmology, so it's a thermal WIMP that's going to decouple. It's going to freeze out at some scale, and it's going to have some predicted relic abundance that you can have. All of these are assumptions. We don't know past BBN, right? So you can change all kinds of things, and basically every assumption you have here can change. You can make the relic abundance larger or smaller. You can do anything you want. The problem is that's the problem with cosmology. You can do too many things. You know, you can do anything you want, and you don't know. So if you assume the standard picture, you get this sort of nice thing where you put in numbers at a squiggle level, and it kind of comes out right where you want. And that's what's called a sort of WIMP miracle. Okay. And I just write down some of the results. So here's WMAP 3, sort of, I think this is a 2 sigma range, so a lot of papers have been using this. There's a WMAP 5, which I didn't bother to write down, because apparently there's now a WMAP 7, and if that doesn't make you feel old, I don't know what does, okay? It's not a remember when they were first putting out all this stuff. Like, what happened, you know? Holy crap. Look how small this is. I mean, this is such a constraint. So when you see, people actually apply, it has to provide exactly all the dark matter in this region, okay, with all these assumptions, you're going to find that some little teeny sliver is going to be cut out of your parameter space, and people say, oh, Susie's in trouble. Well, look at that. I mean, it's impossible that that's going to be covered over all your parameter space. So this is just the norm. On the other hand, this is assuming not only all these things, but also that the neutrino provides the entirety of the dark matter. Even if you don't want to go touch the cosmology, the scariness that is cosmology, you can even say that, well, particle physics, we could always imagine that it's not all of it, and there's some other particle physics stuff out there, some axion or something else, filling it up, even though that sounds kind of ugly, but you know, you can do that, and then you can just put an upper bound, right? And so sometimes people do that, okay? So just keep in mind all these things are assumptions. I think even getting these numbers, there's some enormous amount of cosmological assumptions in there. I'm not an expert on that. I think even just to look at how precise these numbers are, you know, it's kind of... So nevertheless, many times you see phenomenal studies where people will put in, well, I haven't seen any yet with the WMAP-7 because it's really quite new, but there was a similar one for WMAP-5, and they put in this tiny sliver. Okay. What I want to say is, remember I just told you, well, suppose you just put an upper limit, and Susie, you say, oh, there's other things. You might think, maybe that helps you. Well, it turns out in some of the simplest models of Susie breaking, including M-Sugra, you typically have too much, not too little. So it doesn't really help that much. And on the other hand, as I said, there is some sort of crazy cosmology you can do to sort of reduce it. Turns out the crazy cosmology you can do to reduce it seems a little crazier than the stuff you can do to increase it. So, okay.
Terry, what do you mean by crazy cosmology?
Well, there's basically things like trying to dilute entropy at later times, and it's just, there's a whole list. I mean, you know, I talk to cosmologists often and usually don't understand what they're talking about, but they talk about these huge, there's basically a whole set of things one can do. It's just there's no particular motivation from any other source to do that. Okay, so one of the things people might say is that suppose you see some possible thing that looks like a dark matter candidate, say at the LHC, and then suppose the, you know, some other experiment, like some direct detection experiment, sees some sign of one, but suppose their predictions don't match, then you might be convincing yourself to go and look at those things. But otherwise, without corroboration, it's one of those Occam's razor kind of things. Why mess with the simplest idea, even though we don't really know? Okay. Now, I also want to mention that LSP neutralino as a dark matter is not necessary in general. It's also not possible in some scenarios. LSP just isn't a neutralino. Okay. You can have gravitinos. You can also have axinos. You can have non-SUSY things. And I'm typically not going to talk about these, but that doesn't mean that they're not important. It couldn't be there. It's just for simplicity. In many cases, when you can apply this, you do, and see what kind of parameter region it prefers. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about building models. And as we know, if you try to build a model of Suzy breaking where you have renormalizable couplings between the sector that breaks supersymmetry and our sector, you end up getting a sum rule that says that you don't have the right type of splitting of the superpartners. You get some are getting higher, some are getting lower, and you'd see them. So you have to have this hidden sector paradigm, which we all know well. There's some place over here where Suzy's broken by some magic. Okay, sometimes you can be more ambitious and try to build some dynamics for that. Turns out for the phenomenology, none of those dynamics are important. Okay, this is why we don't worry about it. What matters, however, is the details in which the breaking of supersymmetry is communicated over to our world. And how that's communicated depends on what kind of fields are doing the kind of mediation, the scales at which they get their VEVs. So this F term is basically this order parameter for the Suzy breaking. The types of couplings between. They have to be suppressed in some way. It can be non-normalizable operators. It could be loop suppressed. There could be other things in sectors, and here you have to loop through to get here. Okay, so this is the general paradigm. And there are three sort of standard mediation mechanisms that people have talked about. Gravity, gauge, and anomaly. I'm going to call the anomaly also what's called bulk, thinking about extra dimensions. I'll get to that in a moment. And what we're going to do is we're just going to start with the gravity one and look at the simplest models that can come out of that. So gravity mediation means there's Planck suppressed couplings between the sectors, okay? And when you kind of crunch through everything, you get the fact that the scale of Suzy, the masses in the Suzy soft breaking Lagrangian are basically the F term, okay, of some hidden sector field divided by M Planck, okay? That's just the nature of it. So it's a high scale mediation, meaning that sort of it's always at some Planck scale where you imagine these things are happening. Okay. So this F over M, F is of course the dimension mass squared. This is always the mass scale, okay? And the fact is, this is a tree level, okay? You have tree level operators, so there's no loop factor out here. Okay. So this is an example of high scale mediation. And so let's talk about minimal supergravity. So minimal supergravity says, let's generate all of our gauge unit mass to tree level with universal gauge kinetic functions. Let's also have canonical Kähler, universal canonical Kähler potentials for all the fields. And those of you who work on string theory or various, more fundamental ideas say, oh, this is ridiculous. It never looks like that. And yes, this is just simplicity, right? So you do that, you crunch things through, and what you find is that you have a universal gauge unit mass, therefore, because our gauge kinetic functions have assumed to be universal. We have a universal scalar mass. There's a universal trilinear coupling, okay? And there can be a universal bilinear coupling if you put in a mu term. I'm going to do what most people do here. You trade the mu and b again for tan beta, mz, and then the sine of mu comes along for the ride. In fact, I think later on I'll forget to write the sine of mu because I got tired of writing it. Anyway, it's always there, okay? So these are all specified at some high scale. This is also called the constrained MSSM. So there are some people that will say, no, M sugra and constrained MSSM are different. And yes, and actually in details they are, because when you say M sugra, it has something to do with, you can kind of relate the A term to the B term that you would get out and other things, yes. But in all practical purposes, it's the same thing. And people use it interchangeably anyway, okay?
Didn't I make another assumption here, which is dimension six terms in the Kähler potential
yes.
are universal? And
yes.
That's actually the crucial assumption?
Yes. Everything is basically saying that we're assuming there's no flavor violation in this thing, which is, of course, the big problem, okay? Because there's no reason to assume that all those terms are going to be there, okay?
Well, you don't necessarily have to assume canonical Kähler potential.
I'm just saying if you have you don't have to assume it's canonical to get a universal mass. You can still have a field-dependent thing as long as it's the same for all matter. But when people write down this first thing, you can just really just put it canonical and you'll get the same thing. So yeah, it's not necessary. So they're specified at some high scale. And what I did was, like Paul, when he did his colloquium here, I also was interested in this, people have done so many studies on M. sugra. It's basically 90% of the phenomenology in Suzy is on this. 90%, I would guess, of the benchmarks, maybe 85, something like that. So, in fact, some of my colleagues at Madison and people elsewhere have done these series of studies about the LHC reach. So they've done it for LHC 14. They got a little sad. You have to do it for LHC 10. And then you have to do it for LHC 7. And they hope we don't have to do it anymore. Okay? So I think we're okay for now anyway. So what you see is actually it's not so bad. So here's all the, integrated luminosities. These are Gluino mass contours. And here's the Higgs mass contours here. And so what they And I just also, they have a table that I provided that I thought was useful. So you show the difference between root S of 7, 10, and 14. And basically, this is the reach for the gluino, okay, for those three cases, okay, depending on the luminosity. And it's not so bad, okay?
What do the Higgs think covers mean? I mean, that means that the reach bubble would be excluded if we didn't.
Yeah, I believe that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay.
Those who are old enough remember there was also LHC 16, period.
Oh, was there? Wow. Yeah, should dust off those old papers and put that in here too. Yeah. They probably have papers on them too. Okay, so anyway, there's the reach.
Just sort of anecdotally, what kind of fraction of the interesting parameter space is that people who played with?
Well, you know, for example, if you, you know, so let's take the least optimistic case. I mean, so, you know, here we're talking about M naught, about TeV, M one half, around 300. I mean, so that's not so bad, okay? There are models where the gluino is, M sugra, gluino actually tends to be a lot heavier than that, it's really not such a bad scenario, I think. I mean, I was sort of pleasantly surprised to see this.
Yeah. And that goes to say you're heavily weighted towards the bottom because...
Absolutely. Square, absolutely, yeah, that's right.
At the time of left, people thought that 50% were over. Center
parameter
space was excluded within parameter space group.
Right.
Roughly you say tuning grows radically along the M-naught axis or something.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So then I stole this plot from Ellis and Olive, who a few years back, there's some people that always just do all these studies on M sugra as well as many other things that they do. They do a huge amount of papers, but you know, they always have these nice plots that you can steal for your talks. And this seems like a couple years old, so I'm hoping they're going to crank out a new one, maybe with that WMAP 7. But okay, here's M naught versus M one half. This is the standard way you represent M sugra. And the green here, and this must be WMAP 3 because it looks pretty thick. Green here is basically the allowed regions for dark matter. Okay, you have sort of the leader excluded regions here, okay, obviously. And what you see is the following. I don't remember the details of the parameter point. This is pretty... You know, there's some value of tangent beta they've assumed here and various other things, but it doesn't change that much, except for if you go to very large tangent beta, some of this stuff in the middle starts acting a little weird. But essentially, this is what you have. You have these four regions. You have the bulk region, which is sort of the low M naught region, so light superparticles. Okay. You have the co-annihilation region. This is the region where basically this some particle co-annihilates with the LSP, so you have to have some particle, it's usually a style. So it doesn't have to be. That's similar in mass enough that it can contribute in some sizable way. You have this, it's called the Higgs funnel. So this is a resonance phenomenon. So when you have the Higgs, basically, well, the LSP is like, what is it? I almost forget now. So you want to basically annihilate the LSPs into the resonance of the Higgs. Okay. So this can be that the little h or the CP odd a Higgs boson or, you know, whatever. So you get this kind of funnel. Then you have this focus point region up here at very high M naught, okay, and that's a case where all the scalars are heavy. You end up getting a Higgsino-like LSP, and it turns out to be okay for the dark matter. So the main point is most of this parameter space out here is excluded. You have these various contours for like G minus 2 and V to S gamma and things like that, okay. But a lot of this is not working, and this is just a statement that typically you have too much. It's a typical problem.
Okay. The funnel region is really the CPI Higgs.
Yeah, that's right.
Because the neutral inner mass is twice the neutral inner mass.
It's got, yeah, this is the A funnel here. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Okay. So you have these four regions. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that typically what you have is that in many of the cases, this LSP is typically a Beano. I mean, when you run, the RGs weight everything, so if you start off universally, you end up with Beano-dominated LSP. And then what happens is that thing just doesn't interact strongly enough to really annihilate enough. So there's just too much of it left over. That's the problem. So you need to sort of mix in a little amount of things that couple more strongly, like a Wino or Higgsino. Okay. And you have to mix in just the right amount to hit it in the right region, though. I'll get back to that, actually. So, yeah.
You assume standard cosmology, but you did something like gauge mediation at a low scale, so you just don't get the dark matter.
Yeah.
Right? Do you actually avoid this kind of overproduction problem, so much more of the parameter space is allowed, or do you get into problems with the gravitino?
I think that the gravitino has problems, but I'm really not an expert on that. I think it's not so clearly easy. If that were true, then it would be a very big reason to think about gauge mediation from that perspective. And there are actually a lot of other reasons to think about gauge mediation, but I haven't heard that one so much. But it's a good question. So, okay. Then I wanted to show you a spectrum. So we're doing a lot of N-sugar. I'm not going to do this with every model. These are these snow mass points and slopes, SPS1A. You know, these are just community agreed upon benchmarks of which, as I said before, 80% of them are MSUGRA and the remainders are some other, you know, basically gauge mediation and anomaly mediation. Okay. This is a particular point where everything's pretty light. This is a very LHC friendly point. Okay. This is why people want to study it. So you see, you have all these relatively low, you know, so here's a bunch of sleptons, here's the staus, okay, selectrons, here's some neutralinos and charginos, and so they're all pretty light, 200 GeV or so. Notice the colored guys are all much heavier. That's typical of MSUGRA. RGEs, if you start universally, the SU3 stuff always just shoots way up. So you get these very big splitting between the gluino, for example, and the other and the neutralinos. Okay. That's the typical picture you're gonna see. And so, you know, this is sort of a very typical spectrum. So if you change the parameters around, you might move these regions up, but these things will also correspondingly go up. So it's pretty characteristic. And this is a sort of like a bulk region point. So we're not in some special co-annihilation or something where something has to magically be at the right place. There you will get something different because you'd have to have the stau close enough, for example, to this neutralino to make the co-annihilation work. Okay. So here's the general features. Colored particles are heavier than uncolored ones in general. Typically you have lighter electroweak enos, so these charginos and neutralinos. Sleptons can also be light. And again, this is just RGEs. Yeah, you start off the same, sleptons go down, scorks go up, okay? Now, there's a thing I'm going to be returning to a lot, which Choi and Nilis have been advocating, and I like it myself too, which is to look at the ratio of the three gauge enos masses to sort of characterize a model. Okay, the scalar part, as you all know, when you're building models, is more complicated. There's more places random things can come in. Gauge enos sort of tell you a lot, and you see we have this kind of 1:2:6 sort of ratio. Okay, so essentially, here's your beano-dominated thing, and then you have sort of a twice as heavy guy here, and then you have the six times up there. So that's the sort of typical range of how these things go. And again, this is just RGs. You start universally and you have it. There's not much freedom there. I also wanted to comment in these sort of supergravity scenarios, you don't really have this issue with this mu b mu problem, although we're not talking about it at the moment. So this is our general features of this MSUGRA and CMSSM. And I thought that since we're at KATP, we should sort of show that people do landscape even in phenomenology. So here, this is a paper of Pranath and collaborators from a few years back, which I think is interesting, and we're actually doing some of this ourselves, my collaborators and I, about some models we're looking at. Want to basically scan through some parameter space. Remember, this MSUGRA parameter space is very simple. There's four parameters and a sign. Scan through them in some random choice of endpoints that you just randomly pick. You can try to prior them or not, whatever, okay? So then you get something where you sort of try to look for the lightest four superpartners, because that's going to tell you about the collider phenomenology, because you have these cascade decays, right, and they eventually stop at an LSP. So you want to see what the next ones up are they made of. Are they another neutralino, or are they a stau, or whatever? So see, here's sort of histogram of how popular the patterns are. We see that charginos sort of dominates here, then the stau. There's a few stops, and there's a little bit with the Higgs. And they sort of characterize all these things and then sort of looked for collider phenomenology. So it's an alternative to sort of picking a bad benchmark from some high, just picking some random high-scale parameter. Okay, so that's sort of a thing people are starting to do. So here's the sort of moralizing warning from this whole story. There's lots of things one can learn from studying MSUGRA, and in fact, that is, if you want to go read a paper on SUSY phenomenology, that's basically probably what you're going to get. But you have to be careful about the standard folklore that you're going to hear. So for example, this is some argument that was in a paper of Howie Baer and Xerxes Tata and some of their students, which I thought was really nice, and it sort of stuck with me, so that's why I decided to share it. If you look at all those dark matter allowed regions, you know, these four regions, then you're going to infer something that if you're sort of making this assumption that the LSP is all the dark matter, then what you're going to find is you would assume that one of these things might be true. So if you're in the bulk region, this is a slow M naught, so therefore you should have many light, you know, basically sparticles, sleptons, et cetera, that you should be able to see a whole bunch of things at the LHC. So that's sort of like something like a good news. In the funnel region, it turns out, if you look in more carefully, it turns out the funnel region only works when tan beta is large, okay? And this tan beta being large affects cascade decays because things couple according to tan beta. This well-tempered neutralino, this is the idea of mixing different bits of Bino and Higzino and Wino. This doesn't work in MSUGRA unless you're in this focus point region, which is that very high MNOT region, where nothing would be accessible at the LHC. Okay. So those are the sort of lessons you would learn if you stared at those things. And, you know, when you're in this field, you see that plot every year at every conference, and so you sort of have this drummed in your head. However, every single one of these conclusions can be invalidated just by adding one new parameter to CMSSM. One. Almost randomly, too. I mean, it's not like it's from some theory. To say, I'm going to have, instead of having all the scalars universal, let me add something different for the Higgses, for example. Gone. You can find regions like that. So you can't extrapolate too much. Also, as I said before, a lot of these, saw that SUGRA spectrum I showed you, everything was pretty stretched out. There was nothing where you saw this entire tiny splitting between particles. So those bounds I was talking about before, you can just naively apply them, and they work. They're perfectly fine. In fact, they were derived probably based on those assumptions anyway. Okay, but when you go on, we're going to find out that you're going to have to worry a lot more about it. So the point is, we learn a lot from it, but you have to be a little bit careful about how much you extrapolate from it. So let's talk about gauge mediation. So we've sort of, instead of going on and talking about more advanced looking supergravity models, I'll come to that later, let's talk about gauge media instead and talk about minimal gauge mediation, whatever that may be. Okay. So again, we have a hidden sector. And as we well know, in gauge mediation, we want to basically have the interactions come through gauge couplings. So what we have is some messenger field. So this X is our mediator, some singlet. The X is a singlet, and it couples through some Yukawa coupling to these messenger pairs, psi and psi bar. These have some vector-like charge under standard model. It's typically assumed that they're part of some GOT multiplet, so they don't screw up unification of couplings and things like that. So you have to go through various loops. Eventually, you get back here because the psi's steer standard model charges, so they couple to gauge bosons, et cetera. So you get the thing. And what you find is because they have to go through loops, again, it's this fx over x is setting the scale, and you have a 1 over 16 pi squared, roughly speaking, okay, because it's a loop vector. Okay. And depending on, so that basically the VEV of this X field is telling you something about the scale at which this is happening. So all you need to know is fx over x has to be a certain value if you want to get a TEV scale out of the MSUSY, right? So you can have different types of models depending on what x and fx is, as long as they give you the right value. So x can be high or low, and typical sort of first model people writing down, they typically kept it low. It sort of was a nicer thing to do, but you can have it higher, okay? So that's gauge mediation. And there's something called a minimal gauge mediation model, okay, where essentially the only parameters are this, okay? There's going to be some sine and mu hiding that I didn't bother to write again. Here's this messenger scale where the things come in. This is, again, this fx over x. I've now put in the coupling. It's got to depend on the gauge coupling squared, right? The n is the number of messenger pairs. And here's tangent beta again. That always shows up. And here's an example of a spectrum again. This minimal model was also picked as a snow mass points and slopes point. In fact, two gauge mediation models were allowed that privilege. This is number 7. This one has a, what is this? I guess the NLSP is a stau. So the LSP is a gravitino, obviously, in such a case. Okay. And so the NLSP is a stau. You can also have cases where the NLSP is a neutralino. And the collider phenomenology depends on that. Turns out, you see again, we have stretching, right? Here's all the colored stuff up here. Okay, here's the non-colored stuff down here. So we have this kind of stretched out thing. In fact, because these things, you know, involve various, you know, group theory coefficients, and they tend to be bigger numbers for colored stuff, they tend to be even more stretched out. Okay. And essentially, the fact that we have this gravitino and LSP, and you know, it's basically the physics of the NLSP that tells you a lot about what's going on in the collider. And these are sort of well-known stories, right? So that basically looking at how this thing actually ends up tracking through your detector. Now, I'll just mention here, and I probably should have mentioned it earlier, that, of course, the reason why these models are so exciting is that, unlike in supergravity, which I totally swept under the rug by not talking about it, we don't have to worry about a flavor problem at all. Because these gauge interactions are never going to introduce flavor mixing. Okay? So we don't have to worry about getting those off-diagonal couplings in our spermion mass squares and trilinears. It's just done. Okay? So that's a huge benefit of such a theory. Okay? Another huge benefit, which I know people here are very well aware of, is that whenever you're talking about supergravity, you start having M. Planck running around, and you start wondering, well, what happens, you know, at the UV? And this doesn't have that. There's no M. Planck is irrelevant, basically. So it's telling you something about the gravity known, and that's it. And so you don't care. So this means you have a lot of control over it in your field theory. So there are a lot of very attractive features of these kind of models. And
it's both kind of a feature for both the
It is, yes.
Lower scales, so.
That's right. So it's kind of a mixed blessing. And I think the fact that, you know, I remember there was some big heyday of gauge mediation in sort of the mid 90s, and then it kind of trickled away, and MSUGA kind of marched on, and then it seems to be coming back, and Cyberg is doing all sorts of stuff. I'll talk about that in a little bit, just briefly. So okay. These things have cycles.
Dark matter in this,
in this in the gauge mediation? Yeah, I think probably I would just do the standard response and say it's the axion, but, you know, I worked at Florida with Pierre Sakivi and everything's like axion. So it's the only place I've ever been where people do a SUSY talk and they'll say neutralino dark matter and the axion. Every other place they're like, what's an axion?
Well, so, okay. People try to do it at very high scales, yeah. Below ground mediation.
Right.
Try to fit in the dark matter.
Yeah, they do.
Does it actually work in detail?
I don't think it's particularly attractive myself. But I have not worked on it in detail, so I don't think I could answer more precisely than that. But yeah, it just doesn't have that sort of popping out kind of feature. It has other features. So, you know, usually it's sort of always a zero-sum game anyway with these kind of business, right? So this is minimal gauge mediation. And of course, there are many other models one can write down. This is just a very simple one. Okay. And, you know, but that's sort of where we're starting with here. So let's talk about anomaly mediation. Now, Shanti, you have to tell me if I'm correct in interpreting your...
Well, for the scalar masses.
Yes. So what I'm going to say is I'm actually going to talk about that, at least my understanding of it, a little bit later. But let me start by saying this is sort of the standard anomaly mediation stuff, where people assume that you basically have this scale invariance anomaly. You have the scale invariance anomaly. You're looking about this conformal symmetry, this conformal compensator, and you end up getting this SUSY breaking contribution, which people claim was for both the gauginos and the scalars. Okay. With this FC over C, where C is some chiral compensator, okay, whatever. It's just something parametrizing the scale. It's a loop effect. As we well know, there are several issues about this. This is a part of supergravity, so typically the three-level supergravity parts kind of swamp it unless you sequester things. So these should really be brains. I haven't talked about that yet here, but one would have to worry about that. There's also the fact that you would basically get this slepton mass problem, meaning that since the things go like beta functions, you end up getting negative slepton mass squares, and that's just, again, you're just dead right away. And it's such a pity, you know, and people were bemoaning that for a long time because it's so minimal and so predictive and so wrong, you know. And so essentially, you have to say, okay, I have to fix it some way, and let's take the most boneheaded way to fix it if possible, but it's also the most practical way, and phenomenologists are very practical.
That's what they're getting me wrong.
Yes, no, this I know, yeah. So assuming that, suppose you try to fix it. And a lot of the model building activity is trying to fix that problem, that quote problem. Okay? So add a common M0. And what this does is this whole thing was so beautiful because it didn't have this flavor problem. And then you're suddenly randomly putting in something flavor diagonal. It sort of become, you get back to like a supergravity kind of thing where you're just putting in something and you didn't have to put that in. Okay, but this is sort of what we call minimal anomaly mediation. Take this thing, add a M0. So you have one parameter, but it's very practical. Okay, so let's look at that. And this is SPS9. Okay, there's only basically a few parameters here. Okay, essentially just this again, the sine of mu. I stopped writing it because I just couldn't stand it anymore. And then here's M0. That's that common mass. Again, look, we have the same sort of stretching. Well, actually, even we have a different kind of. We have a very stretched galeno. Okay. We have the Wino is now the lightest one. So M2 is the smallest thing. That's just from the beta functions, the way they come out. Okay. So then we have M1. So we have this different feature where now we have this highly degenerate chargino neutralino, okay, because they're both governed by M2. And then here's the neutralino 2, and then here's the Gluino. Again, we notice how we sort of stretched out in the. So all these minimal scenarios have this case where essentially all the colored things, and I want to particularly point out the gluino, it's always been at the top of all these charts. What I'm going to talk about later about some of the things people have been doing recently, some of them string motivated, you're going to see the gluino is going to start coming down. And that's going to be interesting because you're sort of thinking about all your LHC phenomenology, thinking about this kind of pattern, you're not thinking about the case where what if the gluino is lighter than everybody else. So there's actually a lot of interesting things to study and figure out. So this nearly degenerate Chargino is one where you have to be very careful with the Chargino bound. And then I say this may solve the flavor problem because at least the contribution of the soft mass squares predicted by this procedure certainly does. It just gives it wrong. So then you have to figure out whatever your new contribution is that, quote, fixes the problem, doesn't mess up with flavor, and that's not so easy. But there are certain ways you can do it. For example, obvious thing would be put in gauge mediation. Gauge mediation also doesn't, and that's one of the first things people did, and I'll come to it a little bit later. Okay. So what I'd like to do is sort of to show you side by side what all these mediation mechanisms really look like, just to remind ourselves, okay? So here's our gravity, F over M Planck, tree level. Here's our gauge, okay? And I just put in, here's the Suzy, and I have to put down the gravitino. So gravitino is always F over M Planck. Okay, so it just depends on what the size of this F is. So I said typically people took the scale low, and that's why this thing was low, and that's why gravitino is the lightest thing. Okay. Here's the anomaly one, once again. And what we see is we have this feature where in the sort of typical gravity mediation, gravitino mass and the soft mass scale is very similar. We have the case where gravitino is much lighter in the gauge part, gauge mediation models, and it's much heavier in the sort of standard anomaly mediation models.
Question about what you just said previously.
Yes.
If you just add gauge mediation, I mean, the F term in anomaly mediation is so high. If you're gauge mediating the same F term, you'd expect really more masses.
Yes.
You have two separate sectors with different seasons.
You do, and what you do is, I'll get to it. Yeah, it's called deflected anomaly mediation, and Palmer and Rotazzi wrote down probably minutes after the people wrote their paper. I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, yeah. They were like that. expert model builders. So, okay. Now let's just say side by side two. This is just a little bit more kind of a phenomenological side. So this is just a reminder of all these things. So here's the LSP. So here it's usually the hypercharged gaugeino, so the beano typically. You can also have cases where the Higgsino comes creeping in. Okay. Here we have the gravitino. Here we have the weino. Then there's a question about the sort of advantage. Here's the mu b mu problem. Easier to solve here. Both of these two, it basically comes out that essentially, you typically get B too large. If you generate mu where you want, B is much larger. Okay, typically. You can also organize something with some symmetries to make it go the other way and make mu be something and B be almost zero, which is actually more interesting. That would give you out a large tan beta relatively naturally. But you don't get them at the same order, which is what you need in the Higgs potential, because typically all the mass parameters are the same order, and you want to get the things to work out properly. Okay. This also is an issue about the UV sensitivity not being an issue here, for better or for worse. Here, minimality plus also maybe flavor. Okay, so distinctive features. So here I want to say spectrum's kind of variable. We saw that there were these different sort of dark matter allowed points, which might say you have some degeneracies of something close to the LSP. Maybe not if you're in the bulk region. So there's a little bit of variation when you do that LSP dark matter. For gauge, it's very simple. It's really all about the NLSP being long-lived, okay, and what that means for your detector, and then this very stretched spectrum, okay? Here, there's a long-lived Chargino, again, because of degeneracy. And basically, the spectrum is going to depend on how you fix this, quote, tachyonic slepton problem, okay? So those are those mediators side by side. Now, where it started getting complicated was I started trying to think about how do we go beyond, and of course, there's many, many things beyond what I just told you. And what I wanted to sort of try to do is to say, okay, well, I tried to find out some ways to classify these things. And then each time I classified, I thought, well, I could subclassify, and then everything was in the same, you know, it wasn't organized at all. Nevertheless, let's just try it and see what happens. So you can start with this where you say, suppose we think about only these previous mediation mechanisms, or we can think about new ones, okay? Yeah, whatever they may be. So that's sort of one level of classification. Another thing is to say, what do I mean by theory motivated? What does that mean, okay? So we can have bottom-up motivation, the phenomenological way, which says, I want to solve problems in the MSSM. I have a flavor problem. I have a CP problem. I have a mu problem. I want to solve it. Let me pick a scenario where I solve it. Or I can say, I have MSUGRA. I have all my codes written in MSUGRA. I don't want to do anything that different than MSUGRA, so let's add a parameter. And actually, lots of things can change, as I told you, so it's a useful exercise. So you can perturb around the known results. It's a logical, sensible thing to do, especially because you don't want to add in tons of parameters, because then there's no way anybody who's ever actually working on the experiment is ever going to look at that. Okay, no way. So want to improve and extend known scenarios or solve problems in some new way, using some or all of these things. Okay? There's also top-down motivation. So think about, say, what you might get from grand unification or from string theory, string-derived or string-motivated. Okay? And you can say, maybe I'll just say, I'm not trying to solve the flavor problem. I don't care. I have some high-energy scenario I'm thinking about, and what does it predict for me? And in fact, those are the things I've worked on more, and I personally find it useful because it often leads you into, the top-down tends to lead you in places you'd never go from the bottom up. Say, why would anybody put all that stuff in there? They wouldn't, you know, you just wouldn't. So essentially, this can take you to places where you wouldn't have thought of before, okay? And what it can do is maybe provide, what I try to do with it is rather than being too attached to any particular string scenario, okay, especially given that it's very difficult, certainly at present, to imagine a scenario where you really have some detailed MSSM with all kinds of things you can predict and you feel confident about, all the stabilization of millions of things. I mean, this is very hard. It's a very ambitious thing to do. I mean, I think it's a great thing that people are trying to do this. On the other hand, if you want to do phenomenology, you say, okay, what kind of ideas are people saying? What kind of Lagrangians do you get? And you can say, what kind of soft models of soft parameters can I write down that encode some of those features that I might not have thought about before? I might not have assumed that this kind of thing would happen. And you can be led into some interesting features. Okay. So again, this is not clean because sometimes doing something from the top down gives you something that solves a problem and some, you know, things like that. Sometimes these things improve. So sometimes you have double categories. So it's really not clean. There's also another level of classification you can say is there one mediation mechanism going on or more than one? And I can tell you that for a lot of the model building that's been done, at least until relatively recently, it's sort of you pick your mediation mechanism and that's your thing. And pretty much everything, all your model's designed so that nothing else is important. And the reason why is, as I saw, you know, when you looked at those mediators side by side, they had certain advantages. So if you're trying to work from bottom up, there's a reason for that. If you want to worry about the flavor problem, you don't want to have something with supergravities flying in there because then you're in trouble unless you really know what you're doing and have something to say about the UV, which some people doing string phenomenology do have something to say about that, but still it's a very difficult thing. So there are sort of reasons for that, but what I want to mention is that this idea that many of these mechanisms are operational at the same time is, I think, something that's a recent lesson coming out from, you know, this progress in thinking about how to stabilize moduli in string theory. Okay, when it trickles down to the phenomenological world, what I've taken from that, besides being happy that that's been done, because I've heard people mentioning it for a long time now, is that it's not necessarily true that we'd assume only one should happen. Now, we know what the patterns of soft terms are for each one, so if we have many of them on, we can sort of try to think about coming up with new models and perhaps new phenomenology by dialing various contributions, ratios of different quantities. And that's a way to sort of generalize beyond these simple minimal models, which is a few parameters, without adding too many things that's motivated from some theoretical mechanism we know about. So that's going to be a lesson we'll come in sort of toward the end. Okay. So this is sort of the level of classification I'm attempting to do. I don't remember what
I... Are you going to maintain the experimental constraint of having less than 5?
I think when we first start, you typically don't have that much ambition. You sort of say, okay, let me see what I can do. And then very often there can be many parameters, like if you're doing string-motivated models, someone says, oh, there are all these modular weights or something. And then you say, oh, okay. And then when it gets trickled down to phenomenology, you say, well, maybe I just won't call those parameters and I'll just fix them to some value, whereas you could vary them. So there's certain parameters you want to try to figure out. Which ones can I fix? Which ones should I vary? There should be continuous ones, and there's also discrete ones sometimes. Sometimes with the discrete, you want to make a choice. So it becomes sort of, I think there's several layers that have to be done before you can kind of make it in ready form to show to somebody that's actually going to be working on the collider. Because they don't want to know what the modular weight is. They really don't. I mean, they truly don't want to know that. I mean, if you show them a model where you have all these things written that way, they're just going to be like, I don't want to have to learn string theory to be able to do this, okay? They're just going to say no. So you have to package it in a way that seems reasonable, and that's not easy. But that's a lot of what phenomenology is finding the right packaging for things. Okay. Yeah. So I started with the simplest thing you can do is let's just extend some known scenario. So as I told you before, all these conclusions about minimal supergravity and dark matter, if you just add in some stuff, one parameter even, you can change a lot of things. So I just wanted to list the kind of things people are doing. Okay. And there are several groups that work on MSUGRA, and this is the kind of thing they're doing. They're perturbing around it. One thing is, before we had an M0 for all three generations. Let's make a different M0 for the third generation than for the first and second. Remember I told you before, first and second better be the same, otherwise you know, flavor starts to rear its ugly head and you have to worry about it. But this is a way to add a parameter. And it frees up the third generation to do something different, and that's useful. And also, obviously, first generation stuff typically is more interesting at the collider anyway. So, all right, this is one set of set. And actually, all these models have acronyms, and I was listing them all at first, and then I got so confused, because this was like NMHM, SSM, and then this one was UH. Ugh. Finally, I said, okay, enough. I mean, you read the papers, it's really like, you read one acronym after another, like, I have no idea what people are talking about. So, separate soft masses for the Higgses. So instead of M0 for everybody's, you know, quarks, leptons, and Higgses, let's let the two Higgses have either some separate common mass, or they can each have their own. And that can be useful for many ways, too. Okay. In particular, since it's the running of the Higgs mass squared that's very important for electroweak symmetry breaking, so you might want to mess around with that a little bit. So people have done this as well. This one's called the NUHMSSM or something like that. Then it was the non-universal gay genome masses where they had so many versions of this, each with a known acronym, where I stopped. And so here you just, okay, M1, M2, M3. So before it's M, now it's M1 half. So we can put in stuff to, you know, you do it judiciously. You pick something so that you can maybe get that well-tempered neutralino coming out. So there's many, many ways you can perturb around that. You can have one or two, okay. And gay genomes are very important. They're telling you a lot about the neutralino sector. It tells you a lot about the dark matter constraints. And there it's just M1 and M2. So it's really only about that sector. There's also M3 with the gluino, you know, changing its running, I mean, changing where it starts off and it's running, where the running is always going to shoot it far up. So if you want to blow it down, you can start with a lower value, for example. Okay. Not that people necessarily do that. They just, you know, change it around and see what happens. Okay. There's also some work where people just decide, okay, usually they start running these parameters at 10 to 16 GeV, the gauge coupling. Okay. Which in itself is already kind of a strange thing to do because you're thinking they're generated in Planck. But nevertheless, we've been doing it for a long time and sort of pretending we're all happy about that. Now, they've said, let's just start running at a lower scale. So let's make that arbitrary. Because the less amount of running you have, the less likely it's going to split. And in fact, the mirage mediation models and some of the stuff I'm doing is stuff where that's coming out kind of naturally from the structure of the theory. So it is kind of related. Right? So from all these kind of things, what you find is you actually have a basically variety of various dark matter allowed spectra which aren't quite so restrictive as what you had before. So that's the M-Sugra kind of extensions. And I'm going to get back to later other kinds of supergravity theories that are more top-down motivated. So this little one means I'm thinking about bottom-up motivation at the moment only, exclusively. Okay. So let's take extensions of minimal GMSV. So people have written down so many gauge mediation models.
Sorry, just one stupid question.
Oh, sure.
In the first framework, if you do non-universal gauge genome masses,
yes.
Does that automatically remove unification also in the M-Sugra framework?
No. I don't think it does, actually, because I think you can arrange your things so that your F terms are different. I mean, you can I think actually get that kind of thing.
So the overall gauge coupling function in front of the whole.
Yeah, I think it works out okay.
Is that okay?
I sort of remembered that. Yeah. Because often that happens when you're thinking about string-motivated supergravity very naively, and you sort of have a modulus or dilaton or whatever. So dilaton was always universal, but modulus could couple differently depending if it's be some higher order thing. And it was always okay. So it doesn't necessarily ruin it.
Oh, it's a solving issue we're talking about.
Yeah, it's okay, right? Yeah. So, all right. So let's go to gauge mediation. So here there's so many papers written on these types of models. All I wanted to mention was that even if you're just thinking about bottom-up, just trying to build gauge mediation models, there's so many things you can write down. There are things called gauge messengers, where you let these, you know, you had some SU5 sort of floating around among your messengers. You can let this sort of X and Y gauge bosons of the SU5 come into the game. This is what these gauge messenger models are. There are also models, which I'm not that familiar with, to be honest, in details, where you try to eliminate the messenger sector altogether because it was kind of ugly. The initial implementation of gauge mediation was sort of hidden, messenger, observable, and it's sort of like this three-step thing. And so people have worked very hard to try to do this. It's, of course, very difficult because you know already if you directly couple the things, you're going to have trouble with some non-normalization theorems and things like that. So, okay, semi-direct gauge mediation has something to do with how you talk about the charge of the messengers. I mean, it's also the different types of things. Seiberg and company have been working the last few years on sort of reformulating and rewriting gauge mediation and sort of a general approach he calls general gauge mediation. And what he's done is sort of parameterized the whole thing differently, right? I mean, he sort of is looking at these correlation functions and sort of writing things down differently. And his whole framework, he's defining very precisely what he means by gauge mediation. He's saying gauge mediation in this, at least by this definition, is defined that your observable and hidden sectors have no interactions if the gauge couplings go to zero. So with that assumption, he's gone and done a bunch of things. And what he's done is, by doing this, he can write down things of a certain sort of set of fundamental parameters, and then they give you actually a little bit more flexibility than usual minimal gauge mediation. And it's some way to try to unify some of these models. But even this approach doesn't necessarily unify all of them, because some of these don't satisfy this criteria. But nevertheless, there's been some kind of revival in gauge mediation. And I think, as far as I can see from looking at these things, you have some sort of nice models with a few, instead of two parameters or whatever describing the masses, now there's maybe four. And these are things that could be packaged in a pretty way. And I think people in phenomenology are starting to pay attention and study them. And then if you sort of analyze them to death, you might find a particular region which is, or a particular parameter set which is worthwhile going further. So there's many, many ways people are doing this. And again, because of the gauge mediation framework just has an attractiveness to it. Somehow this way the flavor problem is just solved, it's a very nice thing. And a lot of people say that's sort of my main motivation for thinking about this, as opposed to supergravity, where I have to know about all sorts of unknown higher dimensional operators, okay, out the wazoo, okay? So this is sort of the most I have to say about this. And again, this is because just trying to figure out how to pick one and figure out which ones to say, there's so many things happening. Yes?
Do you get any progress from considering extra new ones like Z5 coming down before mediation?
Yes, definitely. I mean, so having the U1 participate in mediation is actually something that, in fact, I think Paul Anger has worked on that. I mean, there's sort of, you can definitely do those kinds of things. So it's not just sort of taking this usual sort of SU5 psi bar, you can sort of start doing it. And a lot of them are going to be kind of combined with what I'm going to call later this sort of bulk idea, where you have sort of things on brains and maybe U1, it's, you know, some U1s on some other brain. And there's a whole bunch of things people are trying to do from the more phenomenological side based on kind of lessons from the brain world.
So does that turn around the tachyons?
You can turn around tachyons and anomalization by doing that, exactly. Yeah. And as I said, a lot of those kinds of ideas are really thinking, we have this anomaly mediation, let's try to fix that problem. And gauge mediation is sort of a logical way to try to fix that problem.
One more question. In that strict definition,
yes.
You know mu and b mu don't work.
Yes,
it's
we do.
Very computable.
Yes.
So once you find a way to solve mu and b mu, do you ruin the other predictions in the general framework?
I think that is possible, but I don't know in details. I think people are starting to study that. I don't know if anybody else here might. Do you know, Leontow, if anybody's looked into those things in detail? I'm not sure.
It depends on the solution. So one of the solutions is to, for example, you just suppress the dimension two. So usually the mu is too big. So you say, okay, maybe mu decouples to some hidden cipher stuff that actually strongly suppress the mass parameters. Then now it depends on how those things couple, you may also suppress other mass parameters as well. So it depends on model dependent, I think, really.
That's one of the reasons why people want to avoid it so much. It's so highly model dependent for everything. So, okay. So I want to talk a little bit about anomaly mediation, and I thought first we'll start by talking about just in general more what we call bulk mediation. So let's think extra dimensions. So instead of just thinking about these being some sort of hidden and observable, let's really make them geometrically hidden. So sequestering ideas here, okay? And the idea is having some bulk field, and then essentially this thing is mediating stuff, and it just depends on how this bulk field couples to the stuff on the brains. And it could be tree level, it could be loop level, it could be all sorts of things. And in fact, we know the sort of standard sort of what we call Randall syndrome zero anomaly mediation thing is something where you need this kind of framework where you sequester, otherwise you're going to be overpowered by any kind of tree level couplings involving singlets. There's also something, a scenario called Gagino mediation, where we essentially put standard model fields in the bulk. And I talk about that. This was a while back, and it made a big splash at the time. I think people are still very excited about it. So Gagino mediation is something where you put standard model gauge and perhaps also Higgs's in the bulk, basically make them bulk fields, higher dimensional fields, and everybody else is stuck on the brain. And then what you can basically engineer that way, and this is in their minimal scenario, is that essentially the Gaginos only kind of get something sizable through this interaction. Everybody else, all the scalar parts are just zero. So this is reminiscent of something, you know, some of those no-scale supergravity where very particular Kähler potential and things were used, and you get the same kind of thing. So this is very simple and predictive, only one parameter. The other problem, though, however, is that since you have to generate all the soft mass, well, all the masses for the supersymmetry breaking masses as particles through RG running, because the M naught is zero, then what you end up having to deal with is that your stau is typically the LSP, and that's bad.
But right? That depends on assuming universal gauging mass.
It does, and I'm going to talk about your case in a minute where you don't. Yeah. So, yes, it does depend on that. So the point is, if you start with some universal gauging mass, everything's about running. So if you start somewhere, it's like this question of, do you get enough running to make the slepton mass squared enough so that the stau is not the lightest guy? And here, it's actually very hard to do that. Okay. That seems like a big problem. So there's several ways out. So one way out is sort of to, I think, postulate slash argue that maybe the gravitino is actually the LSP, and we don't have to worry, it's just the NLSP. Okay. Another thing was, I think this was Schmaltz and Sliba had this idea where we include some running effects above the gut scale to sort of, you know, boost this contribution of the stau on this problem. And this problem happens in, even in minimal supergravity, right? You have M0 and M1/2. And depending on how they are, you can get something such that your M0 is not quite big enough so that you get the stau LSP. That will always be the lightest sort of spermion, right? Another option is to include anomaly mediation. Okay, so you say, oh, well, I have this nice setup where anomalization is working, so let's just put it in there. And then the idea was, you have this kind of, here's a nice example of kind of a mixed breaking scenario. So this sort of bulk mediation plus anomaly, and then you have to argue here why they're the same order to sort of make it all work out. Okay. So that's one set of models. And let me talk about deflected anomaly. So now I've sort of talked about bulk mediation, and I've talked about, you know, the idea of putting in anomaly mediation sort of fix those things. Let's talk about deflected anomaly mediation, which is what I was saying, this paper that they wrote sort of minutes after the anomaly mediation paper, probably, where they say you can have naturally comparable anomaly engaged mediation terms, and what you have to do is have an X field with some sort of self-couplings, and all I have to do is basically look at that X, and you're going to get this relation. In fact, later on, we're going to see in some of the string-motivated things that I'm doing based on mirage mediation, where you include an X field in the usual way, you actually get this exact same relation, which is kind of interesting. So you get this relation between the two, and this N is just some integer, right, some power. So you have something which is some number times this, so you have them naturally of the same order. So this is an example of a mixed breaking scenario where you don't have to argue why they're the same order or not. So this is probably one of the first where this was happening. And it's quite a nice theory. Okay. Now I also put in a few more. There's also the idea of hypercharged anomaly mediation. Okay. So this is when you have you have some bulk kind of framework, and I believe you have a U1, the hypercharge is sort of associated with a different brain, sort of brain world sort of setup. And so it's sort of in a bulk in some sense. And that combined with anomaly mediation can get you some interesting spectrum, which cures a slepton mass problem again. You have a kind of interesting and unusual spectrum where the beano is ultra heavy, just very different. Sleptons are also big. This is just because of the hypercharges involved in things. Okay. This was some work of Leontow and others from a couple years back. There's also to add what we call Z prime gaugino mediation, I believe. The authors are all in the room, so I'm scared. Okay, so this is some idea where we can have some kind of bulk framework. We have a U1 prime, we have an extra singlet, so we're sort of solving the mu problem, and we're letting the Z prime gaugino kind of couple in the same way. And again, this is another way to sort of fix up not only the slepton mass problem, but also since you're having a U1 prime and a singlet, you can go into NMSSM kind of land, and this is a way to look at the mu and B mu problem. And this is the work of Paul and Leontow and some other people just a year ago or so, maybe not that long ago.
That so also helped,
helped by the Higgs?
Hide
the Higgs.
No.
Okay.
But in this case, the scalar is always pretty heavy, so the Higgs mass is not a problem. Yeah. So.
And I also want to mention, it's not really the right place for it. This is another place where the taxonomy is starting to get crazy. You can also just think about Z prime mediation alone. So you can have some scenario where it's really the Z prime only coupling. Again, Paul and Leontow worked on this a few years back as well. I think it's an interesting theory. Again, you can look at the mu and B mu problem in the framework. And what you find is a very interesting, very split spectrum. So you have ultra heavy scalars in certain things, and you have much lighter gaugino, right? So I think that when I say ultra heavy, I don't mean to sort of scalars at TeV and gauginos are sort of hundreds of GeV. I think it's more like 10 TeV. Is that correct? Yeah. So it's almost like a split Susie, you know, but it's coming out of an actual model rather than just saying, let's just take M naught and dial it up to infinity, okay? So that's another example of a theory. And there are many more. I mean, so there were so many that you kind of get a little crazy. So then now I'm going to talk about Shanta's theory, which I think is very interesting. So here's, back in this work, the claim, if I'm, and again, correct me if I'm stating it incorrectly, was that essentially you just want to worry about vial invariance, right? And so it should only be the gauge unit masses that get a contribution from this, quote, anomaly mediation. Then there is no slepton anomaly mediation problem because there's no slepton mass, okay? Now, what you might say is, well, wait a minute, for the gauge unit mediation stuff I just talked about, we had the same issue. We had nothing being generated for the scalar parts, for the M0 and the A0. But we had some gauge unit and we had to get everything running. So aren't we dead again? And the answer is yes.
What is the difference here between this and the original anomaly mediation?
The scalars and A terms, they don't get any contribution from anomaly mediation. This is from, yeah, I'll let you take the floor.
Come to my talk next week. Well, they are very surprised. It's not zero, but it's a large volume scenario.
So it's not a disagreement about the calculation. This is a different scenario.
It's string motivated in that it's motivated from that to be compact mitigations with not volume.
So it has different behaviors.
Yeah.
So you're saying the top-down input is different, right?
Yes.
Anomaly mediation, if you're sort of not thinking about it, is if you can do what you said, but you're saying in that scenario, this is what you should do.
In the scenario, there will be anomaly mediation.
Yes.
It's a question of
how the size of it.
Yeah.
Okay, right. So, together with Howie Bear, there was a nice sort of phenomenological study of this theory. And what you find is, since it's anomaly mediated contributions to the gauge unit masses, they depend on the beta function, so they're not universal. The lack of universality is going to actually save the style from being too light, and you're going to get a viable theory with an extraordinarily restricted and nice set of parameters. So this is pretty nice, and they have a nice study where they do a bunch of collider physics and things like that. Again, because this gauge unit co-member, that was that ratio of the gauge unit masses, we still just have anomaly mediation, so it's the same, okay? But we have very different spectrum in terms of the stau, I mean, sorry, the sleptons and squarks, et cetera. And so I didn't see in your paper one of those nice, you know, draw all the lines saying where all the masses are. So I wrote this one instead. So this is the M3 halves, the gravitino mass is their overall mass parameter. And essentially just looking at the particle masses for various different ones, if you can read that, okay, in this particular theory, okay, as a function of that parameter. So this is a very minimal and interesting model, I think. And certainly from the phenomenological perspective, it's one that I wouldn't be surprised if it gets promoted into a benchmark kind of thing because of the fact that you're starting with that. You know, and you don't have to hide a whole bunch of crazy string theory stuff in there, you know. Not that we think it's crazy, of course, it's just them, right? Okay. So finally, I wanted to talk a little bit about, let's talk about supergravity, sort of string motivated or string derived supergravity. And the usual scenario is we have all these moduli in string theory, right? And they're sort of, you think of them as being the mediators. They're going to be the things that are going to interact with Planck suppressed operators to your observable sector. So for example, take a Kähler module. So it could be some of the other moduli. Typically, this is the one you take for something simple. There's always some radius of your compactification volume. You can always use that. And you're going to get your F over M Planck becomes basically the F term of this T for T plus T bar. Okay? And the primary issue for such, I mean, these ideas have been around for a long time. And the primary issue is essentially how do you stabilize all these moduli that you have? And because before, I remember looking at these kinds of things a very long time ago, and there was always this issue of you sort of can derive all kinds of things based on the couplings, but you wonder, we don't really know how to set these VEVs, what's going to happen, and the new physics coming in that's going to fix that, going to mess all this up too, right? So we had many, yes?
Another issue is just flavor violation.
Yes, there's always the flavor violation issue too. So again, it's a supergravity theory, so one's going to have to worry about how to suppress all those flavor things. And I think in general, it's not obvious that that's going to happen, you know, definitely. And often people just talk about sort of the very sort of leading order kind of simple thing that you can think of, but these are a whole bunch of Planck suppressed operators, and you've got fields of Planck VEVs. So you're not done at all. So you can't claim you've solved anything. Nevertheless, at least from my point of view, you want to just sort of extract things from a phenomenological point of view, you can take that tree level thing and use it as a toy model. You just can't claim that's what string theory is predicting. Okay. So maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you just want to get a nice model that's something different. Okay. So I have a couple of little paragraphs about some of the things that we were hearing about. And again, I'm scared because people in the room probably know more about this than I do. But there are a lot of people here, this, at least at the last few days, they were here for this string vacuum project workshop, where they looked at these models based on G2 constructions of M theory and made the statement that these moduli are stabilized from some non-perturbative hidden sector dynamics. You get a mixed Suzy breaking scenario where you have both gravity and anomaly mediation. Okay? And what they have is actually a very strongly split spectrum. So I'm trying to use certain words to mean something. So stretched means sort of things are sort of TV-ish at the few TV-ish at the high end, 100 GV-ish at the low end. Split means you're up in the 10-100 TeV range, and still hundreds of GeV for the rest of the guys. Okay, so you have this kind of split thing, very heavy scalars, and also Higgsinos. Okay, I'm not exactly sure why that happens. I think that's kind of interesting and strange. So what that means is that Higgsinos are sort of out of the picture when it comes to the dark matter part. Remember, we want to kind of mix in something with our Beano or whatever to kind of try to temper it. You know, try to get the thing to annihilate more, so we don't have too much of the dark matter floating around. So now we have to do it with other things. And here, basically, they have a model where it must be anomaly mediation dominated because they get a Weino LSP in some limit. Right. So you have this Weino LSP, which is clearly something that from the standard dark matter picture doesn't work. But I know, Gordy, you have a way to fix everything, right? So non-thermal, it all comes out. OK, right. So anyway, they have this very interesting sort of scenario where they have these very light Gaginos and very heavy scalars. So what you find is this Gagino includes the Gluino. So again, I don't have a picture yet. I have a picture for later for some of the things I worked on because I make those pictures. But if you look at where the Gluino is, it's on the bottom now. Not the tail bottom, but it's like one of those light ones. And so that means all the LHC phenomenology of this kind of a model will be extraordinarily different. All these very heavy scalars, they're just out of the picture. And all you have are these light things. And so it's a very different physics picture. And I would imagine at least there should be some interesting different signatures that maybe one can sort of look for and try to see if this kind of thing is happening or not.
Can I make one point?
Yes.
Weino LSP is possible, but it doesn't have to be Weino.
It doesn't have to be Weino. You can have Beano?
Yeah.
Okay. No. So, oh, I get it. Okay, I worked for him too. I know. Okay. So now let's talk about large volume conductifications. Okay. Don't worry, Gordy's a friend. He understands me. So large volume convectifications. This is, I believe, of type 2B string theory. And this is just some supergravity theory where they include, I believe, alpha prime corrections. And they have some small parameter because they have a large volume, right? So they could do some expansion. And, you know, from reading some of their papers, I saw that basically they claim that their moduli are all stabilized from not only fluxes, but also some quantum corrections of their superpotential. And they also claim, which I think is remarkable and interesting, and I'm not sure, you know, I don't really understand it, but they seem to get flavor diagonal things, even though they're doing these higher order corrections. Which, if that's the case, that's a great thing, and that's why they got a little bottom up is all for that. Okay, so this is Conlon, Cavedo et al. And again, I'm sure people here know more about it than I do. I think a lot of these things are very interesting. I mean, so even at the level of just trying to understand it in terms of the string construction, I think a lot of them are at that point now. All I can tell you is that unless you're working very close to these things, it's not very easy to read those papers and figure out what's actually going on in terms of the phenomenology. So they need some filtration down. But both of these scenarios look like they're interesting things to sort of start from in order to build certain models. Yes?
So in this model, every Higgsino, what happened with electroweak symmetry breaking?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Electroweak symmetry breaking?
They have electroweak symmetry breaking. You just have to tune the parameters.
It's fine-tuned.
So
everybody's big, and you just have to get a small number out of it.
Yes.
It's a fine tune.
I might say this Z prime model that Leontal and I did had a spectrum that is very, very similar.
Oh, that's right. It's a very heavy.
And again, it's a it had Weino LSP, although it didn't have to be. But. But it is a fine tuning to get the electroweak breaking. I mean, anytime you get a split spectrum, it's
yeah, you're going to have to fine tune it. Right.
That's fine tuning all models.
Yeah. All right. Good.
Actually, there's a sort of generalized model of a paper with Bobby where you can tune one parameter, you can make all these scalars light as well. And entire order correction to sequester.
Well, that was the point of your talk yesterday, but it's not clear how you can calculate the storms at all.
So you can do the packaging for this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for that. I mean, but if you want people to pay attention to it, at least on certain side of the community, that's what you have to do. And you can't start talking about modular weights and, you know, Delta Green Schwartz and all that stuff. You just can't do that. Okay. All right. So other examples that I'm not going to talk about, but we heard some things about at the CP were these F-theory guts and various intersecting D-brain models. And again, I welcome anybody who wants to say something about those. Feel free. Okay. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that I've been thinking about and many other people as well, which is, again, some theory-motivated kind of, they're basically supergravity theories again, so they're string-motivated supergravity. Okay. And the motivation's coming from these KKLT ideas, right? And essentially, what you can get out of this kind of thing is that in such a framework, you can build basically phenomenological models in which all three of the mediation mechanisms I talked about, gravity, gauge, and anomaly, can all come in and have comparable contributions. Okay? And that's something I think is interesting. So there can all be kind of similar order. And what's interesting about it in particular, and that's the thing that the Mirage mediation people were the ones to figure out, was that usually you think gravity anomaly is not going to happen because gravity is always tree level and anomaly is gravity but loop level, so how is it ever going to work? And what happens, essentially, it's because of warping, I guess. You get some sort of log factor, and Planck over M3 has, it happens to be in size of a loop factor. And so then you can get things which are similar in size. And then it's actually very easy to couple in some singlet field and, you know, an X field and some messengers. You typically have those extra guys around in these string motivated, you know, any string construction, you typically have extra singlets and you have extra vector pairs anyway. Whether you get the exact precise couplings you need and whether that X can't couple standard models, so you have all sorts of, if you're really going to put it into a construction, there's tons of things you'd have to worry about. I'm not worrying about any of them. I'm not claiming anything beyond this is a string-motivated model that is worth, that is interesting and worth thinking about. So the usual thing was called mirage mediation, which just had the gravity and the anomaly. When you have all three, we call it deflected mirage in the spirit of deflected anomaly, because that was when you sort of put the gauge in. Okay, and that is what it does. It does deflect things. So let's just review the mirage mediation a bit. So here we have the usual setup. Here's the observable sector here on this D3 or D7 brain. You have your Calabi-Yau, you have the moduli and stuff in there. You have the hidden sector at the end of the warp throat. You go through the usual procedure. I'm sure everybody knows these things by now. And what you find is you get the typical scale of the gravity mediation terms, Ft over T plus T bar, goes like the anomaly mediation sort of M3 halves times a log factor. So what you end up finding is that these things are similar. And remember, the Susie breaking scale for anomaly mediation was 1 over 16 pi squared Fc over C. So basically, you get something in the right kind of ballpark. Okay. So these things are kind of similar. Yes?
So when you add M-play brains, typically, you also introduce that term called complex structure.
I'm sure that's true.
And as far as I know, those guys
are not. I'm sure that is true. I mean, I think the point is, as I said, well, I can't speak for these guys. I'm not on these papers. But what I can say is my own purpose, and I think it's valid as long as you state it properly, is just let's take this assumption. We're throwing out everything else that might be there and probably is. Okay, probably all kinds of things are there. Let's take this. Let's turn the great. What we find is an interesting result. We can get something where we have comparable contributions. And it's only interesting if it leads us to some interesting phenomenology that's different from what we already had in different models. Okay. That's what makes it interesting, is the phenomenological implication, not the theory implication, because if that's your interesting point, you better go through and make sure you know what's happening in your setup in details, right?
So you're using warping to make up for the difference between a tree level and one loop path?
Well, I think I was saying it a little bit sloppily. So all I'm saying is we get this factor, and it's basically like a 4 pi squared factor. And one kind of imagines that maybe it's where this mysterious 4 pi factor comes from might have something to do with the fact that one has warping in the throat, very roughly. I understand there's a more precise thing that people do and calculate to do all these things properly. And if that's not the right words, I'd be happy to have somebody tell me so I can make them better.
I just worry that it's really parallel.
mean, if it's sort of like covering the formula, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's a mystery, right? So
I think that log is coming from the way that you stabilize the volume with an exponential effect against the tree level effect.
Right.
So you're not controlling in 3/2, so you get the log from doing the stabilization.
Right.
You already have that play out on the shrink of the Schrodinger versus log.
I think that's
to make the stabilization, and then it's okay to use that.
Right. Right, and I think also, I mean, some of this weighting between the two is certainly has a lot to do with the details of how you do this uplifting potential to cancel the cosmological constant and do all this stuff. So there's a lot of pieces to it. I mean, at the end of the day, and the fact is, it's just a numerical coincidence in some sense that this comes out to be of a nice size. But that's actually interesting, right? So you have this sort of feature where they can come in comparably, and you don't necessarily trash the anomaly mediation part, assuming it's too small. That's essentially what's happening, because the gravity part is being suppressed. Okay, and that's a nice result. And people realized it was nice a long time ago, and there's been a lot of work on this. And one of the other reasons why it looks nice is because the soft terms have a very beautiful and very strange feature, which is that, why do we call it mirage? Because they appear to unify at some random scale. So it has nothing to do with where any new physics comes in. Okay, we have, here's where they start out. Okay. And they unify here. In my plot, we actually use two loop RGEs, so they don't quite unify, okay? So if you're wondering why they're not quite crossing, that's why, okay? One loop, they unify exactly. You can just show it. And again, it's at some particular scale, and you can write down what the scale is. And it's this quantity that's called alpha m, and this is basically the ratio between the anomaly and the gravity-mediated contributions, okay? And it happens not only in the gauginos, but also in the scalars. And you might say, well, who cares? Well, the point is, it's not that there's anything magical happening here. However, you do see that essentially how the things run depends very much on where they meet at a certain point. So if you want to squeeze your Gugino spectrum, which you might want to, maybe we can take this and move it down here. In fact, you can do that if you let alpha m equals 2. If you just work it out, it's all going to work out that way. And in fact, the Mirage people played around with that, and then they are concerned because it's hard to understand how this alpha m equals 2, they had a hard time understanding why that particular form of the uplifting potential or whatever it was they needed to put it in there, why it would precisely be the right value to make it happen. But nevertheless, the main point is this. You see right around here, they're very close. So if you want to take that thing and move it around, that's one thing you can do. Okay.
The scalars unify at the same point?
Yes, they do, in mirage unification, yes. So this is when you only have the anomaly and the gravity mediation, they all unify at this place, okay? And you see, in a moment, when we turn on the gauge mediation part, this part's going to be messed up, but then the Gugino part, we're going to be able to deflect this basically wherever we want. Okay.
So that's the scale that is the same as alpha m independent. That's a generic
yes.
statement that unification happens at the same scale for both of
yes,
them.
Yes, it's a generic statement. It's because essentially, I think the reason why this is a running feature, and then the anomaly mediation terms have things that depend on beta functions. So basically, there's some conspiracy, and it all works out. That's, I mean, it's kind of interesting. So, you know, people get excited by that, also because it's kind of a strange, interesting result. So let's add in the gauge mediation part, okay? And so what we did, we just say, hey, you know, we've worked on string models, at least the phenomenology of them, and we know that you're going to have singlets, and you have extra vector pairs, and exotics, and all kinds of stuff. So suppose, on our observable sector, we have some X field, which is some singlet. And suppose we have these kind of pairs, and this X couples to psi bar the way it would in gauge mediation. Now you might say, well, this is not looking like a gauge mediation setup, because usually you don't want the X directly in the observable sector coupling. That's true. So one would have to basically make sure, in a particular construction, this X would have to obey all kinds of rules. Not obvious at all that that could happen. So let me just make that clear right away. However, what will happen is that X is essentially some kind of matter modulus field. It has some singlet. And so what it's going to do is it's going to mix with these other guys. And what you can do is show, in the same spirit as the deflected anomaly mediation, that you can essentially get that this Fx over X is similar in size to Fc over C. And so since mirage mediation already told us that Fc over C and is related to Ft over T plus T bar in such a way that you have this kind of relation that the soft terms between the gravity and the anomaly are similar, then that means the gauge ones are similar too. So then we can put in all three of them. Okay. So let me just make a little tiny comment here. It's just, if you just assume that X has no couplings at all and just has some kind of radiative stabilization, if you just sort of do some naive thing where you write down its F term, okay, and then you essentially assume that these basic terms are similar size and plug in the usual values for the Kähler potentials of the matter fields involving this T plus T bar, you get right away that Fx goes like minus M3 halves times X. Okay, just some squiggle kind of back of the envelope calculation one can do to do this. And this is the kind of thing you get. Now, if you have this kind of superpotential coupling involving these x's, then what you can show, and this is exactly the deflected anomaly mediation result, which is interesting because they had a different set of assumptions. Nevertheless, you get the same kind of relation that this fx over x is some numerical factor, where this n can either be, so we took it either as some higher dimensional operator be the normal thing, we also said, well, let's let it be negative also, and then we can sort of pretend that we're doing non-perturbative physics, and that's going to tell us something about the size and the sign of this this ratio between the two things, which we're eventually going to call a parameter. And since we're phenomenologists, we're eventually not going to use this parameter n, which is in some sort of discrete values. We're going to call it something like alpha. We call it alpha g, and we're just going to let it slide. And again, not because that's what you'd expect from the theory, but because we want to just take a case. Well, we have this kind of connection between these two things, and we want to parameterize it and see if at certain values of those parameters, something interesting can happen. Yes? Anybody have a question?
One negative n, actually?
Yeah, we do. I'll show you why. Yeah. We're going to actually want that. The reason why I'm going to say we're going to want it is it's going to turn out that the stabilization by the higher dimensional operators, so what does gauge mediation do? It picks in threshold effects at some scale, right? So does anomaly mediation has those same threshold effects. So what will happen is they're going to add constructively for one sign and destructively for the other. So it turns out then when this alpha is positive, this entire, this is a minus sign here, so when this whole thing is positive, they add constructively and you get a big threshold effect, and that's what's going to throw your unification, Mirage unification scale down, okay? Or up, depending on how you do it, right? So if it doesn't, then they're going to almost cancel each other and it's not going to be much of an effect. But that is some, in some sense, you know, that's the thing that you would do if you just naively wrote down higher dimensional operators. So that's saying something too. Okay. Yeah. So here's our parameterization. So here's just the usual Mirage. Here's what I just wrote before. And so let's just rewrite. Again, this is just like what the Mirage people did. You call M naught. This is the usual gravity mediation part. You have the FC over C is related by including this log factor to M naught and what we call alpha sub M. This is what Mirage people call alpha. You have fx over x is alpha g times fc over c. So that's sort of replacing this by that. And this is our set of parameters, and it's not experimentalist friendly yet at all. Because we have all these, you know, these would be, for example, the modular weights of the matter field, so how they couple to the T modulus, for example. So one would want to just fix those and just not even tell people that they exist, otherwise they'll freak out, right? Even then, we have what we have. We have one scale. This is one mass scale, this M naught. We also have another mass scale, which is the VEV of the X. That's the messenger scale where the gauge mediation comes in. We have then a bunch of dimensionless parameters. Okay, this N is the number of messengers, number of psi-psi bar pairs. So in terms of the dimensionful parameters, we only have a few. And then we have these ratios. And the idea was eventually, so we're just sort of really starting to study this theory, and so right now we've just been picking certain values of these things. But the idea is eventually to kind of dial between. And I think I might have that on the next slide if I organize things properly.
But yeah. You have negative powers of this field, like n-type only?
Yes. That's what one would need to have the big effect, yes. So it's not so pretty, right? Yeah, definitely. Yeah, anyway, so this is just showing the actual term. So here you see this is how the threshold corrections, they come in, these things add. So if they have the opposite signs, it's not going to work. So this is how it works. So essentially, large effects for this, small for that. And this is the non-perturbative, quote, non-perturbative negative power. So we just let that happen, just to see what would happen. The X field and a superpotential.
We're calling it non-perturbative because it can come in at like Einstein
relays. We're calling it non-perturbative because we didn't know what else to call it, basically. Yeah. So, yeah. It didn't look perturbative to us. So, yeah.
This deflecting thing,
yeah.
Right? So forget about supergravity.
Oh, the deflected anomaly mediation,
yes.
Right, yes.
I would assume they
have the same issue?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. But I think in that case, let me put it this way, you still get a change in things, and I think you can still, I haven't read the thing in details for a long time, but I think you can still kind of solve this negative slept. They had different goals. I mean, so our goal is to try to, yeah, I think our goal is to do this, you know, so this is why I deflected. So this is the Gaijino sector only. This doesn't happen to scalars, only the Gaijinos. And what happens is here we basically made this thing positive in order one, and we have this huge threshold where the, and the, basically this messenger scale is there for 10 to the 12. So you see they have this way these things run, it drops down, and then it's unifying right here, okay? And so we have this incredibly squeezed, compressed Gaijino spectrum. But this is not happening for the scalars. So in a normal mirage mediation model, if you could arrange your parameters such that you got such a mirage unification in the Gaijino sector, that would also happen for the scalars. So that would be an incredibly compressed model, period. Here we would still have a splitting between this and the scalars, which aren't that far apart, but they're still not at that same squished level, okay?
Are you telling me, oh, okay, that's already mirage, but just deflected. Do they use this alpha G negative in their solution?
I would have to check.
To the anomaly, you know, to the negative.
I don't think they do, but I would have to check.
Yeah. I mean, the negative power is something that can easily happen without scalar
determination. Yeah, it, yeah, right. It can happen. That's right. That's right. It can happen.
Just the prototype gauge mediation is people like to, you know, we struggle to create these Polonyi terms, right? Use them for gauge mediation. And
right.
Here seems to be, phenomenology seems to tell us different. The defect is more drastic if you...
At least in this scenario. I don't know about the other case. But they do have the same, you know, same prediction between the things. And so it looks like that would be the case. The effect is more dramatic the other way around. Anyway, so you can, again, solve for what this... mirage scale is, and it's same alpha m over 2, and then there's another factor, and this other factor is kind of an ugly mess, but it just depends on, you know, the number of messengers. So we see also that how you go back to the mirage limit is you just set n equals to 0. So you might think you set alpha g equals to 0, but no, those messengers are still around affecting your running, right? So therefore, set n equals to 0, then basically you get back to 1, and that's the mirage limit, okay? So this is what I want to show. So this is sort of the phenomenological viewpoint why we were kind of interested in it. So the idea was, here we have been sort of focusing on corners. So models with anomaly mediation, gravity, or gauge. And then people have started to do things along these line edges here. So here's deflected anomaly where they have both anomaly and gauge. Here's mirage. And the idea was to try to write down something just purely phenomenologically where you're kind of going through the middle. And the hope is to see if something interesting comes out. If you end up getting a bunch of models that look like M. Suger, well, who cares, right? I mean, but probably not. In fact, we already see it doesn't happen. Okay. All right, so what I want to say is, because of the various freedom we have at the moment, it seems like there's a lot of variety of possible spectra you have. So the Galeno can be heavy, it can be ultralight, all kinds of things can happen. Typically, though, you get some squeezing in the Gaijino masses. Okay, because of the fact you have some mirage unification at some scale. Okay, and as I said, the strongest effect happens for these large threshold corrections. Galeno can be light, it can even be the NLSP, which is very strange. It's very easy, because you have the squeezed thing, to imagine mixing the Beano and Weino and things like that together. Okay, I'm not talking about the mu problem in this scenario, which is a problem because it involves anomaly mediation, gauge mediation, all the things which have problems with the mu problem. So the Higgsino, I don't want to make a statement about yet. But in this case, you can typically get easily mixed Beano, Weino, neutralinos. When I say easily, I just mean relative to models like M. Suger or various other ones where you have just, that's it. There's only one thing, and there's no other guy nearby to make this happen. Okay. Now, scalars can be, in this deflected mirage case, significantly heavier than all Gaijinos. Okay, still only several TeV or so. But again, one might be in some scenario where it's really the Galeno is the lightest colored guy, again. And that's one of the themes from today, is that it seems like a lot of different models of these sort of beyond minimal are leading us into that point where Galeno may be lighter than everybody else, and that might be interesting for the point of view if it's LHC signatures. One would also have to think about that too, yeah. There is a bound on the Galeno mass, I believe, and I haven't checked the model dependence of this bound, but the typical number people quote is 300 GeV. So usually it's not that bad.
That's very model dependent.
Yeah, so it would seem, right?
As a G Likert just showed me something, you can kind of glean it as a light of 100 GeV, squeeze.
Just make the decay product soft, right?
Yeah. But other particle bounds are softer.
as a group on
Oh, you mean the ones I showed earlier, the stop, the stow and the stop, I had 100.
Stop is just enough. Just producing stop is what it is.
But you said the 300 is very model dependent.
300 is extensible spectrum from, so 300 or 400 basically is where the Teletron wave crashed off. So that's where the, and because Beano is light, then you can jet. That's where.
But you're saying you just alter the pattern and that doesn't have to happen anymore.
So. Yeah, so if you squeeze the spectrum.
Anyway, it sounds like people are starting to reassess all these bounds so that we can all know what we're supposed to be looking for. All right, so this is a mirage mediation example. I just wanted to show you there. If you take this alpha m equals 2 case, then you see that we have this case where we have everybody kind of unified at this low scale. Right? And this tends to give you, actually, in details, you typically get a Wino LSP. It's hard to tell. It's very close. And one of the things mirage people are trying to worry about is whether you can actually kind of mix this up a little bit enough to make things work out. Nevertheless, this kind of scenario has been exciting for people because, you know, one of the things one worries about is sort of huge differences in particle masses regarding this little hierarchy problem. So the fact that they're all kind of small and close was looked to be a good thing. So I just wanted to show a threshold, but it's not leading you to some unification at the low scale. Here's the spectrum, and here's the Gluino down here. So we see already we have something where the Gluino's gone from the top towards the middle. And you can even adjust it further. Okay. Anyway, I'm just showing a few of those. That was with a particular messenger scale. If you make it low, then maybe this is a favor to Gordy. So we can make this mirage indication happen here, but then the threshold can happen lower than that. And then what will happen is that it's kicking it down so low that essentially our M3, you might think, okay, it's been boosted down, it's the smallest, but it's actually the magnitude of M3, so therefore our Wino is the lightest one. So we can get our Wino LSP. So that was my holiday present to you, I think. So anyway, and you see here, again, we have this kind of case where here we see there's the Gluino and there's all the other guys. So it's a very different sort of pattern than what you saw before. And I have tons of these things, but I don't want to go too far into it. But let me just say, if we take the perturbative, so higher dimensional operators, so say like the fifth, then you see not much is happening. You get a little bit of threshold only, and you do get a split. You don't get that squeezing. And again, here's the Gluino up on top where it was before. And I think I'm going to skip that for now. I just wanted to say briefly, I'm almost done, that I think I've said all these things in words up to this point, to say that when we think about our model list, especially when we go beyond the minimal models, we've seen a huge variety of different kinds of spectra. We've seen compressed, that might be this mirage with the alpha m equals 2, where everybody's, there's like the squeeze gauginos and the scalars sort of doing their thing. There's the stretching, which is kind of the minimal case. And then there's a split where you have this tens of TeV scalars and lighter gauginos, for example. Okay, so I would say SUSY signatures are sort of well explored. Even that's probably a little bit too strong a statement. In minimal models, this is when we're typically doing the phenomenology. There's a lot more intuition there. But new patterns have new signatures. And this is something that actually Leontau was telling me about recently, which is that suppose you have this light Gluino heavy scalars, then what happens is now the Gluino decays dominantly through these off-shell squarks, right, because the other squarks are heavier. And then there's a preference for the third generation because that tends to be lighter. And then what it has is that's affecting the way these decay chains work, and it's quite different. And he told me that this was actually a very encouraging signal. And I haven't studied it much, but I'm sure he's right because he knows about these things. So there's lots of interesting patterns that might happen, at least that one could test whether such ideas make sense or not, relatively early stages of the LHC. So it's not like you have to wait 10 years until they ever get to 14 or 16 or whatever and, you know, get to somewhere. Relatively early, one should be able to at least test these sort of sets of ideas. Let me also comment that a lot of these compressed things, so we're sort of taking a spectrum and we're sort of squishing it. And so it might seem like we win at some level because the things are getting lighter, and so you should be able to produce them more, but also they're decaying in these softer decay products and it's harder to see them. So it's sort of a little bit of a sum game, but a lot of the cuts, okay, I mean, I shouldn't say it's too strong of a statement. I'm really not an expert on this, so do I have some experience? There's sort of a standard set of SUSY cuts you do when you're sort of doing analyses, but these are probably optimized to M-Suger type of spectrum. So the point is, we would probably need to go through and look at the cuts, optimize them to your new pattern of parameters. So there's sort of a lot of things, at least from the theoretical motivation side, where you can, you know, actually find some new regions to sort of look for how to optimize searching for your signal. So I think that's an encouraging sign of all this work. I think that's the end. So you know, I said everything here. I think the model building for these same reasons is still of great importance in the LHC era. So maybe not everybody's wanting to do it. A lot of people want to just go and make sure they can, you know, calculate the collider physics. But we still need to understand how to understand whatever physics we might see. And what we've seen is just by thinking about relatively recent ideas, a lot of these were quite new, okay? What we can do is go beyond these kind of M. Sugra thinking, which is really dominating all the literature. We have to kind of remind ourselves not to extrapolate, and people are reassessing all these bounds and all these things, making sure we know what's happening. And there are many types of theories, and you know, I just focus here on the one that I was working on, but there are many that are interesting. And the point is, a lot of them are very simple but rich frameworks, and they still need to be packaged up to really do proper phenomenology with them at the level of the LHC. But we're sort of getting there, and we might find some nice minimal things to think about for benchmarks rather than just minimal supergravity or minimal gauge mediation, et cetera. So thank you for your attention.
Let me just remind people that because this is the focus week, we have another seminar just in a little less than an hour by Lian Tao Wang on LHC physics signatures. And so we'll have just enough time to get some lunch. But are there any urgent questions?
Can I ask one question? Or
sure.
It might even be a comment, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I mean, an interesting fact about your talk and most talks I've seen like this, there's gauge mediation, which is beautiful, and really has nothing to do with string theory. Maybe you need to dualize if it's strongly coupled or something, but it has no plane sensitivity.
Right.
There's gravity mediation, which a priori has a lot to do with UV completion. And the most sensitive question there is flavor.
Yes.
It's a question of whether dimension six operators are for some reason universal,
right,
when there's no low energy reason.
Right.
Now, with regards to that, it seems to me an obvious question for string theorists is to find cases where you can do an honest computation and show that you get universal dimension six terms for a reason that we can understand. And it seems to me the history of this field is cyclic, because in the old heterotic string days, people had a scenario called dilaton domination.
Yes, right.
They would get, you know, a good universality leading order.
Right.
A very beautiful paper by Yossi Neer and Jan Lewis showed that that's not sufficient.
Right.
We've come another 10 years since that was killed, and it seems to me all the ideas in your talk that refer to flavor universal results that depend on gravity were again of this nature, that there's a universal free ball of contribution.
Yes.
Certainly with Connell and Govedo, that's true.
Yes.
And in anything that people have said in KKLT where I can understand the calculation,
yes,
that's the best they've done with universality. So has anyone thought about analyzing submeeting corrections to dimension six, you know, flavor-dependent couplings to see whether gravity mediation ever works in string theory?
Can I comment on that? I mean,
yeah,
you can also have family symmetries.
Sure, absolutely.
Right? And that would ameliorate the problem with flavor violation. So if the first two families are in a doublet of some non-abelian family symmetries, and this comes out of the heterotic string models that we've constructed, then the F terms, the T moduli couple universally to the first and second families, and so if you have F of T Zizi breaking, you don't have problems with flavor violation necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand the Kähler potential flavor aspects to do that calculation.
Well, absolutely, but what that points to is when people are quoting these scenarios and saying that they work, A, they better have a full standard model with the origin of flavor completely specified, and B,
very
they
tough,
better have computed, yeah, alpha prime corrections to the Kähler potential.
Right.
And I think the number of models where that's been done, the result is claimed to be universal, and it can be justified,
right,
by means more intelligent than it randomly worked.
Right.
It's very small, and I think that's a big problem for our community.
Well, I mean, the point is in the large volume scenario, where my favorite one, version of it, where the anomaly mediation actually dominates the gauge masses come from that, and then running give you the scalar masses. The volume suppression suppresses all the. I mean, the volume suppression suppresses the string scale also, right? Not way below, not to the intermediate scale, but you know, somewhere below the gut scale. In that case, the flavor non-diagonal terms are also suppressed.
I think the nature of my comment was just sort of a challenge to the community. Maybe there's a scenario that does this automatically.
Well, I mean, I'm claiming that generically you can make it work in these large volume scenarios.
So certainly the calculations of soft terms that I've seen don't make that clear. If with anything other than just the Gino masses at a high scale, the calculation has not been done in sufficient order, as they know.
So just a comment that you included all these mediation mechanisms, but there's another source of Susie Brinkman which you didn't include, which is D-term.
Yes.
And any string model, there's typically this anomalous U1.
That's true.
Paying the obvious D-term.
Yes, that should be there, yes. I mean, of course, these D-terms, you know, they dominantly affect just the scalars. You always have to get a Gugino mass out there. So that's part of why, for me, the sort of, you have to have an F-term. Right, but yeah, absolutely, D-terms are there, and they change all kinds of patterns. And so it would be, you know, very important to look at those. And I actually have studied those things. Yes, they can. Yes, they can. That's true. That's correct. Yeah. Turn around the tachyon leptons. Yes, they can. Yeah. Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment related to yesterday's talk, is that in our model, the assumption is that the Keeler metric for the visible sector, the flavor structure of the Keeler metric for the visible sector, is assumed to be such that the leading contribution and the submeeting contributions have the same flavor structure. So there's one matrix that controls the quadratic piece, so the same flavor structure appears in the quartic piece. It's the interaction between the hidden sectors and the hidden sectors. But you don't have to assume flavor in the solid here.
Yeah, you're talking about alignment, basically, right? I mean, so if you don't want universality, you can try to do alignment, but then you, yeah.
Scalar mass squared, all of the derivatives are going to be proportional to the same matrix. And then once you diagonalize the kinetic term, the mass squared will be diagonal automatically.
Okay.
So you don't have to assume flavor in the cell.
It's very hard to justify your assumption, right? Because, you know, unless matter comes from the same codimensional 7 singularity and argue that these corrections both have this, it's very hard to justify what you're
doing. You can, well, you might be able to use the street simulations in this argument, and we can be able to use this job.
Yes.
I was wanted to ask, maybe a compressed spectrum can be problematic. If you don't show that, you know, you can accommodate standard electroweak precision.
That's true.
Because
yes.
Then you still have a still harder problem.
Yes, that's true.
So have you made any calculations?
I haven't done that yet, but basically that's another thing one does, is that once you have this full scenario, you look at all those electroweak precision things and make sure that that doesn't kill you. So that delta rho constraint was one of them.
Yeah. Okay, let's thank Lisa.